Corin was very serious when he said that we should start on time.
I'm here.
So that we can go home for those who can go home or those who need to go to a different committee. Are we ready? Okay. We're going to call this meeting back to order. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you recall, we had all but one of our proponent witnesses, and we will begin with that, and then I believe we have two or three more opposition witnesses. So with that, I'd like to just proceed and answer.
Madam Chair, member of
Thank you. Good evening.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And Madam Chair, can the people that are testifying pull it close to their mouth because it's hard to hear otherwise?
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Corin. That's please.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Braymeyer, and I'm a financial planner and co-owner of Amore Coffee. I'm here for Metro Independent Business Alliance. Metro Independent Business Alliance was founded 3 years ago. Our purpose is to help locally owned independent businesses do three things: network and educate the public as to the importance of supporting locally owned independent businesses, and three, to be a voice to our government officials. As a current president of Metro IBA, I thank you for this opportunity. The most recent study in Minnesota showed that 90% of new jobs were created by small businesses. In America, small businesses provide 60% of the employment. 40% of those are businesses with five or fewer employees. Small business is the economic engine of Minnesota. Based on our local membership, health care is the single most stressful problem they face. It is robbing them of their economic viability. We surveyed our members with the following questions. How many people are in your organization, and do you offer health insurance, and if not, why not? We received much more information than the information or to the answers to those questions, which I will elaborate later. Our members have an average of 19 employees. Half of those employers provide health insurance. Here are some of the responses. I offered group insurance, but no one could afford it, not even me. I was denied in 2007 from Minnesota Care because they added in one half of the depreciation back into those calculations. I was denied in 2008 because of my asset level, which is all in my business, and it has not shown a profit yet. Another one. When I'm interviewing, I ask if they have or need health insurance. If they need it, I give them an application for Minnesota Care. Another business said, I offer it now. I will have to drop it next year because of affordability. Another one, I offer insurance, and each year I have to sacrifice in order to continue it. The first year was my salary, then it was my wife's salary. This past year, I had to let someone go. There's not much else to cut in the coming years. And this last one just kind of blew me away. 2% of my covered employees had major health issues, and my insurance is going up $400,000. Now, we must stay with this carrier because no one else will insure us. And we had to raise the employee's deductible and decrease the amount that we can contribute. He goes on to say, now we have a bigger job, to help them think positively about what we do to afford them. But it isn't easy. Imagine being resented for reducing your contribution percentage and raising their deductibles. The Minnesota Health Plan would be a huge boost to 504,000 small businesses in Minnesota. This bill will provide a significant and dramatic economic stimulus. Moreover, this is a win-win for the people of Minnesota. Every person pays for health insurance, whether by premiums, or when they pay for any goods or services, or when they pay tax. Minnesotans pay for the uninsured and the underinsured, but the full disclosure on this is only understood by those who understand how the system is set up. This is the number one domestic issue in the United States. The Minnesota Health Plan will solve it in Minnesota. This legislature has the power to pass this bill now. The information is well documented. We just need to look at what is good for business and what is good for the people of Minnesota. The approach of the Minnesota Health Plan is not just the best solution. It is the only solution. To summarize, this bill creates a large pool of all Minnesotans, collects the money through an effective and efficient means into a publicly controlled central fund, pays the docs and the hospitals a fair, timely payment, greatly reduces the cost of administration, billing, and dealing with third parties. We're all going to pay for health care costs. Let's do it in an effective, cost-efficient, and streamlined way which utilizes our health care system to its fullest. During elections, we put our faith in you to help our state to be the best it can be. We urge you to stand up for the people and the businesses of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Braemeyer from committee members? Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, with that, we're done with our proponents, and I have John Tyler. I don't know if there's any particular order, so.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Senator Marty. Mr. Tyler, good evening.
Senator Marty.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you. If you could please introduce yourself.
My name is John Tyler. I am a board member of Citizens Council on Healthcare. I'm also a licensed insurance agent in Minnesota. I've been in business through Boies and Tyler Financial Group and HSA Health Savings Accounts Incorporated since 1981. Professionally, I am involved with insuring individuals, small businesses, medium businesses, and large businesses as well. So, and I quite frankly applaud this committee and Senator Marty for bringing this issue forward, because this is one of the more challenging and complex issues I think that we will face in our time. The as my involvement with this is somewhat of a historian as well of the last half of the 20th century. And the last half of the 20th century has taught, I think, many people many things. And one of the things that it has taught us, if we look to the last half of the 20th century as far as health care through single-payer systems, whether it be United States of America, whether it be in Canada, Great Britain, European countries, et cetera, one thing that we know for sure is that we cannot offer health care affordably, either as a right or as something that is offered through a single-payer system. Ultimately, rationing occurs. Ultimately, the cost of the system breaks down, and as it becomes a burden on the taxpayer. Ultimately, the insureds of the country suffer through rationing and through a lack of supply of adequate health care. The United States of America, through the Medicare system, knows this to be sure. We have a single-payer system presently in Medicare that is not doing very well. We have a single-payer system in Medicaid that is not doing very well. We have a single-payer system in general assistance medical care and Minnesota care that is also extremely expensive. The forecast for in Minnesota for 2008, it will exceed $8 billion between general assistance medical care, medical assistance Minnesota care, et cetera. That's an average cost in excess of $8,000 per subscriber per year and going up rapidly. It is not compassionate for government to make promises that it can't keep. It's not compassionate for an employer or an HMO or an insurance company or a for-profit or a nonprofit organization to make promises that it can't keep. Earlier we heard testimony from people who have suffered because of promises that cannot be kept. Single-payer anything, centralized anything through healthcare is not affordable and quality cannot be offered. This much we know through the last 50 years of history. So that's some of the bad news. Some of the good news is that in Minnesota, we have one of the highest rates of insured individuals in Minnesota, or in the country. We have over 93% people that are insured. They may be overinsured, they may be underinsured, but at least they're insured. And that's some of the good news. Most states in the country would do envy us because of the fact that we only have a 7% of our population that are uninsured. 41% of that 7% are eligible for some kind of government subsidized program but choose not to participate. 32% earn incomes of $50,000 or more but choose not to participate. 11% are temporarily uninsured between jobs, et cetera. And so the vast majority are reachable, in my estimation, as far as obtaining quality health insurance coverage is concerned. But some comments have been made, some statements have been made that we have a free market in health care. Health care, and I should say health insurance in particular, is probably the most heavily regulated industry in the country. We have not had a free market in health insurance since World War II. We've had employers offering benefits on behalf of employees. We have not had the end result on the individual consuming the health care as the purchaser. We've had somebody else. We've had government. We've had employers. We've had somebody, anybody, everybody has been buying insurance on behalf of the consumer, unfortunately. We would all love to have to see that situation rectify itself. The bad news is that there is no HMO, there is no employer, there is no government anywhere in the world that can offer health care and health on an affordable basis long term, quality health care on an affordable basis long term. Worldwide, the countries that have tried this are scrapping them. They are privatizing. They are moving away from single-payer systems. They are moving away from the kind of plan that is being proposed here. And they are moving in the direction of, the good news is, there is somebody that can control health care costs. And that good news is, it is the consumer, if allowed to do so, in a truly free market for health insurance and truly a free market for health care. We need to get, we as employers and government need to get out of the way, allow some assistance along the way for capable, responsible people to properly insure themselves, and to help along the way through tax deductibility of individual policy premiums to make it as affordable as possible for people to purchase their own health insurance. In Minnesota, we offer in excess of 60 state-mandated benefits that basically says to everybody buying an individual policy, even if you don't need this coverage, you must buy it because somebody out there does. So you must pay the premiums for that person out there who does. It increases the cost of individual health insurance by 20% or more because we have over 60 mandates in Minnesota. I would suggest that we substitute 60 mandates for 60 options. Let people choose a la carte from a menu of covered services that they desire and require as far as themselves and their families are concerned. Let them choose that to a degree that already exists. People can choose mental and nervous condition coverage. They can choose chemical dependency coverage. They can choose maternity coverage, for example, et cetera, and there's others as well. Preventive care services on a first-dollar basis, you know, goes on and on. But right now, the key issue here is affordability. Affordability for the state, it's affordability for insureds, it's affordability for employers. The one thing we don't have right now is affordability as far as health insurance premiums are concerned. The other part of this that I would like to stress is that this is not an insurance issue. This is not an insurance issue. This is a financial issue. Insurance is part of the solution, but it is not the solution. It is part of it. Insurance plays a role, and the only role that insurance can play long-term on an affordable basis is to insure the catastrophic risk. It cannot insure the doctor's visit, the prescription drug, a nickel-dime type of sniffle and cold situation, and expect to keep things affordable long-term. We need to have a situation where the insurance part of the financial solution is for the catastrophic, defined as what the individual cannot afford to pay for themselves. If we do that, we will keep the insurance companies happy with attractive loss ratios, which will not necessitate double-digit rate increases long-term. We have seen some of that experience already with high-deductible health plans. The premium increases have moderated and stabilized for individuals as well as small employer groups as well. The other part of the solution is with account-based coverage. Account-based coverage that the consumer owns. Allow deposits that might have gone for very expensive health care or health insurance premiums to be deposited on a pre-tax basis. We have that legislation, in fact, right now. Qualified health savings account programs paired with high-deductible health plans that allow people to self-insure and save money over the long haul on a tax-free basis. A dollar in and a dollar plus interest comes out. You can't get more efficient than that as far as health care financing is concerned. And when you compare the consumeristic model that allows individuals and employers to make deposits into an employee-owned account, they can save from day to day, year to year, throughout their careers. They can accumulate funds within that account. They are accumulating funds within that account to supplement the high deductible insurance. The high deductible might be as high as $2,850 single and $5,800 family, you know, per year. Premiums plummet when you have deductibles like that. That's all you really need if you have account-based coverage on the front end, taking care of the small items and letting the insurance company be the insurance company for the catastrophic types of things. This type of technology is the technology of the 21st century, not the 20th century, that is achieving remarkable results, remarkable results. The Netherlands have junked their single-payer system. They are doing exactly as suggested. They are getting involved with helping people afford to buy their own private, individual, high-deductible policy with account-based coverage. The results have been phenomenal. Singapore has had the same type of system in place for years. I would suggest and highly recommend to this committee, look beyond the single-payer model of the 20th century. It is a failed model. Government is not designed to be efficient enough to provide the level of benefits that you desire. Employers through insurance companies are not efficient enough. Only in a consumer-driven, account-based model that uses insurance, don't get me wrong, need deep pockets to help people afford things. But the remarkable thing about these types of plans is they minimize the consumer out-of-pocket liability and they maximize the first dollar benefits through the account, especially over time when accumulations that are unused from year to year accumulate and become equal to or greater than the major medical policy deductible. I would like to highly suggest that you consider making tax deductible individual policy premiums of this type and further accentuating and further promoting these types of plans throughout the Minnesota Care, medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, preliminary cursory analysis of the three major government assisted single payer systems show at least a 25% reduction in cost to the state. I'm talking billions of dollars, a good $2 billion in savings to the state. Look at using the worst case possible rates, using fully funded savings accounts, 100% of the deductible, for your Medicaid, Minnesota Care, General Assistance, Medical Care population. Cursory analysis of the Minnesota Employees Benefit Insurance Plan with a consumer-directed model shows a savings to the state of Minnesota of $25 million or more. We're looking at funding 75% or more of the deductible with this type of a model. Employers and employees both may fund these accounts. So there is a way to get to full insurance. There's a way to get to affordability, but it isn't through single payer. It isn't through HMOs, and it isn't through nonprofit or for-profit insurance companies. It's through a blend of catastrophic insurance and account-based coverage. The marketplace is proving that right now. Utilization rates are plummeting for non-necessary care. People are saving money in their accounts for future medical expenses, and it's working out very, very well. And so it's the only environment that I have actually seen premium reductions, both on individual and group plans with this type of a model. This is what the state of Minnesota needs to properly assist their population in getting themselves fully insured and properly insured for the kinds of things they need to be insured for. Let the individual choose the kind of coverage they want. Let the savings account take care of the routine types of things.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tyler. Questions from committee members. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And excuse me, Mr. Tyler, I think you were here earlier today when we had the previous testimony, and I'm wondering if you could comment about one of the points that was made a number of times by the previous testifiers, the proponents who talked about the savings from reduced administrative costs that would accrue to a single-payer system and that this money would be saved out of the excessive administrative costs that currently exist in the system that we have today. And I'm wondering, you're involved in the insurance industry. Do you have any information or can you comment on what kinds of administrative costs are typical in the private sector versus what goes on in the public sector?
Surely.
Mr. Tyler.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Looking at administrative costs, depending upon whether it's group or individual plans, from 8 to 12% of claims is typical. Government types of plans, anywhere from 20 to 25% costs. When you talk about everybody that it takes to run the plan, the efficiencies just don't hold up no matter what country you're talking about as far as providing administration of claims, enrolling people, and so on and so forth. It just isn't as efficient as it's supposed to be, as we would all like it to be. Level of administration cost just isn't there. In fact, government is not the most efficient model I would submit for anything as far as administration costs are concerned, and that isn't going to be the case for healthcare either. However, a savings account situation where you have a dollar in that earns interest and a dollar plus interest comes out of the account is an efficient model. And most healthcare claims are financed through the account, not through the insurance. Most people will never scratch the insurance policy during their lifetimes. but they will utilize the savings account quite extensively. And that is the most efficient type of model in our family's health savings account. The interest we earned on our account this year paid for our preventive care services on a tax-free basis. It doesn't get any more efficient than that. And I think that's the kind of thing that can be extended, that technology, the 21st century, can be extended to the uninsured population. That's a good deal to people. They will come to that. They will move. They will flock to that type of environment. They are flocking to that type of environment.
Senator Hahn and Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tyler, just a little follow-up on that. So what you're proposing as an alternative is that we promote the use of health savings accounts and use that to pay a fairly high amount of annual ongoing costs, which, if I understand from my reading correctly, that for most families this is not a huge amount of money. It may be a couple thousand dollars over the course of a year, maybe even less than that. And then use the insurance feature to provide for catastrophic coverage of things. And now what about in the case of a low-income person or family that does not have maybe the resources to build up a health savings account or to maybe pay the premiums on even arguably lower-priced products? What would your suggestion be and how that situation would be dealt with?
Well, those are the types of individuals that will actually benefit the most because those are the ones that are most sensitive to out-of-pocket types of expenses. However, the total cost of that type of a plan needs to be looked at. I think the federal government right now has a system in place where individuals that are struggling to pay for their Medicare supplement policies have a system of subsidy that the government provides them that will assist them in their premium costs. So they have the same benefit that everybody else has, the same type of policy that says the same type of thing on the card. But then when they go to the pharmacist, they go to the doctor, but there is some financial assistance in paying the premiums directly to the insurance company on their behalf. That's a beautiful model. It allows them to maintain their dignity. They have the best type of coverage they can possibly get. And for many people, it doesn't cost them anything net. And that is possible because the net cost of the insurance policy is very economical. It's very economical overall.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tyler, I heard you say that your health savings account, the interest on that account paid for all of your medical services for the year?
Paid for our preventive care.
Preventive care. I mean, how much do you have to have in your account to be able to earn that kind of interest in a year?
My family and I have been, Madam Chair, my family and I have been accumulating in this account since started off as a medical savings account in 1997. We have in excess of $12,000 in the account that we've accumulated. We've drawn on the account as needed and put money in, drawn on and put money in. Overall, so we have about $12,000 in the account. We have a portfolio of mutual funds within that environment that allows us to earn interest. You take 8% of that money, and that allowed us to have our routine exams paid for by the interest.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
So you need to get to about a point, about $10,000, $12,000, start accumulating enough interest possibly for this interest to pay for preventative services
For our family.
For your family.
The savings account itself, by definition, covers preventive services.
Okay. And, Madam Chair,
Senator Dahl.
What I'm interested in knowing is, if off what Senator Hahn was talking about, is if you have a major disability, if you are someone that suddenly finds out, multiple issues hit you where you don't have the money in your account to cover this. Is this catastrophic plan you're talking about cover any contingency, or is there limitations within this high deductible plan you're talking about?
It's a major medical policy that covers physician, hospital, medical, surgical, prescription drugs, office visits, chiropractic services, et cetera. It has a $5 million major medical maximum per individual in the family.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tyler, I know that I've heard some accounts where, say children, they have a heart condition. By the time they're four, they've gone through several major surgeries and have exhausted their medical benefits. What do those people do then with your plan when they've reached, by the time the child is 4 years old, no longer have health insurance benefits? How do they pay for the continuing care?
Well, anyone in the state of Minnesota that exhausts their insurance benefits, and it could happen, to anyone. $5 million is not an unusual major medical maximum per insurer, but let's say that you do that. Any individual has access to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association on a waiver of their pre-existing condition basis. They have exhausted their benefits, through their standard insurance plan.
Okay.
For an additional $5 million of benefits.
Okay. And if I may, one last thing, Madam
Please,
Chair, Mr. Tyler, the... You're not addressing the cost drivers, though, in this system. It's just mainly how we would. You're system is how we would pay for it or finance it. How do we get the costs of this system under, or non-system, as I would call it, under control, if we're not applying the pressure, if we're allowing the, as you say, the free market to kind of decide, if medical technology is still allowed to kind of run rampant, as we understand there's a supposed arms race for medical technology and the like, pharmaceuticals we can't negotiate with. How do we address those issues into your plan?
Madam Chair, may I?
Mr. Taylor, go ahead.
In your the packets that you have there, with, that look like this in the manila envelope, that says Senate File 2324, shows a study from by Blue Cross and Blue Shield. This is a study that they are uniquely qualified to provide us, and this is over a number of years of ensuring individuals that have these consumer accounts of some kind, whether they be medical savings accounts, as they were previously known, now health savings account programs. And they talk about utilization. It's a utilization study, and the cost drivers of premiums is utilization, whether it's a premium on a single payer plan or it's a premium on an insurance policy. It's the utilization, and one of the things that has been absent is a motivated consumer. That's why these plans are called consumer driven plans. Very unique things about the study, because we do live in a cause and effect world, where people do have involvement in the account. They do have an incentive to economize, to be smart, to shop around, dial for dollars, et cetera. They do have the ability to ward off or get rid of unnecessary care. So the level of hospital admissions for people with accounts goes down. The level of emergency room goes down. Doctor's office visits go down. Total costs go down. Part of the reason the total costs go down is because people tend to dial for dollars. They become very sensitive to the fact that even though we have a provider A that's a Blue Cross Blue Shield provider, and provider B is a Blue Cross Blue Shield provider, provider A and provider B do not cost the same. They both have contracts at Blue Cross and Blue Shield, but it is not the same contract. They are motivated to call and ask the question, what does a doctor's visit cost? Because they have an account on the front end, and if they save 20% on the cost, they save themselves 20% of the cost. Soon, people learn that different vendors, different pharmacies, charge differently for the same drug. I had this introduced to me in a client's office on the second day of individual employee meetings introducing these plans, and an individual came in and said, guess what? I did an analysis last night of all my drugs, and here's the list of the top 12, and see how they range for the same exact generic drug. They're all over the map. All over the map. I didn't know that. That's a consumer-driven model, and they were teaching me, I'm a health savings accounts type of guru, right? They were teaching me how to be good, smart consumers. You wrap that together, and that the utilization is the main driver for government to be able to be of the kind of assistance to the Medicaid, Minnesota Care population that you wish to be, and I applaud you for that. You need to harness that technology, those incentives. You can better help them help themselves, because you can't do it for them. I'm sorry. I've been trying for the last 25 years. You can't do it for them. You have to help them help themselves. And they do a fabulous job. By the way, the less rich they are, the more they work at it. Trust me, they do. And the more they economize, and so they accumulate monies in their accounts. You'd be amazed at how quickly they accumulate monies in their accounts. And so that's really the gist of it. Single payer, help them help themselves to buy an individual policy, deduct the premiums, deposit money on their behalf into the account. State is perfectly qualified to do that. Make a deposit into their account. Help them to pay for the routine things, but allow them the dignity of having the unused amounts accumulate from year to year. And better help themselves. So once they are not on a plan anymore that requires financial assistance, allow them to take that with them into the free market and continue on and be self-sufficient in the free market. That's the engine that needs to be harnessed to be successful in this effort to help people help themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, just two quick comments. And the first one is that I don't think it's fair to compare any health care reform that somebody might propose with our public health care programs, because we have no underwriting in any of our programs. So we have all the disabled people, the elderly, low-income people, the people that can't you know, get insurance or can't afford an MSHA policy. All of those people are in our public programs. And so we have higher costs than you would have if you're talking about looking at anything across the spectrum. And the second thing that I'd like to say is that it was about a year and a half ago, we looked at the health savings accounts that exist in the state of Minnesota, and half of them had no savings in them. And that was because the employer was not contributing anything to the account, and the employee could not afford to contribute anything. So employers were just using these types of plans as high deductible policies, which virtually left many of these individuals underinsured, really. And so we have to be careful. I mean, I'm not saying that a health savings account is a bad idea for everybody, but to come in and try to talk about it being the panacea for everybody, I think is sort of the wrong way to go with this idea as well.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Erickson Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tyler, you mentioned that the single-payer model around the world is a failed model. I'm just wondering in which countries you have major candidates running for national office that are running on a platform of dismantling their national health care programs.
Well, the Netherlands has just dismantled the national health care programs in favor of the same model that I just described to you. And this is the system in France is one that they use such as similar instruments as Medicare supplement plans to supplement their programs that they have there. It's in process of transition right now. United States Medicare is in the process of going to a privatized system. Medicare Part C is an individual policy. It is not. It's a part of Medicare, but Medicare pays the premiums to the insurance companies in the process of privatizing right now as we speak. Medicare savings plans are part of Medicare Part C by Unicare. Someone can buy that, and the premiums are paid by and the deposit made by Medicare. And so the individual has the same types of coverage I just described to you, the same type of savings account that I just described to you as well. And the point has been made and well taken that health savings account programs aren't much of a health savings account if we don't have a savings account funded. I mean, it's, you know, a high deductible plan is a high deductible plan. It's only part of it. If the HSA is not funded, either by government or by an employer or by the individual, it's not a health savings account. It's just a high deductible program. It has been missold and misrepresented in that regard.
Do we have any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Tyler, for your testimony. Senator Marty, there is one more person.
Go ahead. Rich Gall, and then
Rich Gall is
Mary O'Connor.
Here today. Thank you. I think if he's not,
there is a Mary O'Connor, I believe.
Mary
well.
O'Connor. Okay, I don't have that in my list. Ms. O'Connor, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Mary O'Connor, and I am City Council member in Brooklyn Center. Our nation is going broke. Then how will health care be provided? This bill will increase bureaucracy and health care costs. To bring health care costs down, you need to step back and allow free market competition. When doctors, dentists, hospitals, HMOs, and insurance companies can compete with each other to get customers, prices will come down. I have thought of a way to start this process. Increase the salary of public employees by about $11,000 per year and let them purchase their own health care. If federal, state, county, city, and school employees were all included, competition to get these customers would bring prices down. We should talk to our congresspeople and to governors and to other state representatives and start this by 2010 or 2012. Costs would come down for everyone.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. O'Connor.
Madam Chair.
Any questions? Senator Worgen.
Not really a question, but I have to make a comment because I love it when people come with solutions. Whether I agree with the solutions or not, it's great to hear them. And you know what? I bet you even under a portion of that scenario, people would start to know what a physical costs and they would start to know what a filling in their tooth costs, because right now we all think somebody else pays for it and we don't have a clue what anything costs. Mm-hmm. And that's one way to get people to start looking at it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And there's so many public employees that this big group of people, they would compete with, I mean, the doctors and hospitals would compete to get these customers, and they would shop for the best price, and the prices would start coming down. I bet within a year, prices would be down for everybody.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Any more questions? Thank you for your presentation. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions. I would want to comment real briefly on the opposition testimony. Like Ms. Bruner for the health plans talked about how they support universal health care. And I'm sure they do. The trouble is, one, I think she would probably acknowledge, as I think other proponents do, that there's always going to be people falling through the cracks. If I'm laid off from a job today, I can't afford COBRA, I'm out of luck. If something happens and I drop my coverage and I have an injury or something like that, I'm going to be out of luck temporarily. And, of course, if I have a pre-existing condition, I got to fight to get coverage. And that only speaks for the people who have insurance. All who don't have insurance, about how we could get them coverage. The proposal for universal health care, the way the health plans define it, every one of my witnesses who told a story this afternoon, every one of them had health insurance. They're already taken care of in that kind of thinking about what universal health care is. They were all taken care of, and yet one of them's losing her home, another one's working full time and being a single parent and going through 15 hours of dialysis a week. So it doesn't fix any of those. I'd love to see something like health savings accounts work, but we have, even if you set fully funded accounts there, that does nothing to control any of the costs. And frankly, you'd have to have comprehensive coverage for it to work, because otherwise you cover the $5,000 deductible or whatever, and then you're out in the cold because it doesn't cover everything. We have one person I'm aware of who had $900 premiums. I told you this earlier, $30 per visit co-payments, $3,000 family deductible, and a $60,000 surgery bill. That's because it wasn't covered. I mean, it was $130,000 surgery, and the health plan covered $70,000, and the rest of it, for some reason, was excluded coverage. So you still have the problems with it. You still have uncovered care. The idea that we would make chemical dependency and mental health and other things options, like the mandates that we're talking about, the reason this plan is comprehensive benefits is because I want everybody to have chemical dependency coverage. We've got 200 people, 169 people last year died from drunk drivers. I think every one of us should want every Minnesotan to have chemical dependency coverage, not as an option, but something they need. In mental health care, a whole lot of people don't know they have a mental illness, and most people aren't going to choose coverage for things they don't think they have. And I think it's deeply in our interest to have people get the health care coverage they need. This proposal, I'm not going to go into any more talk about it because you've been patient and listening to it. I think it's a good proposal. I think it would cover 100% of Minnesotans, not 93%, not 95%, and 100%, and it takes care of the underinsurance problem. It means you're not going to have people going bankrupt because of health care. It covers all the needs. It focuses on prevention, and that's the way we're going to be a healthier people that way. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and I'd like to have it that 5-6 years from now we have this plan in place and you don't have 22,000 emergency room visits for dental care. So anyway, I'm happy to stand for any questions, but otherwise I'll move Senate File 2324 as amended be recommended passed. It would go to the Commerce Committee, I believe.
Senator Marty, before you move, I wanted to thank you for doing this. As I hear the testimony from all the people that came today, but particularly from Ms. Jordan, I am very moved and very encouraged by the work that you have done. I know that you have involved a lot of people, doctors, community advocates, and members of organizations who help patients and who deal with people like Ms. Jordan. And when people talk about the technology that we have and the best healthcare system that we have in this state and this country, what I have to say is, but what is the use of it? What is the value of having the best technology and the best system if 500,000 people in Minnesota cannot afford it. So for me, this is an issue. Somebody who testified earlier said it is not compassionate to promise something that we cannot deliver. And so my question will be, is it compassionate to continue to have what we have? Is it compassionate to have 500,000 people without access to health insurance? I think that you have done tremendous work to bring us in the right direction. Your proposal may not be perfect, and I wish I had the skill and the background to make it perfect, but I think it's a step in the right direction, and we need to have the courage to add the language and to make the amendments that will make your proposal perfect. So thank you for doing this and taking the first step. Any other comments from members? Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, I appreciate the presentation of the bill, and I think this is certainly a discussion worth having, and I'm glad that you have initiated that. One comment I guess I wanted to make, and I got some information about a recent report that the Department of Health published health insurance coverage in Minnesota, and what that report says that there are 374,000 Minnesota residents without health insurance, so slightly less than 400,000. And as has been pointed out here a number of times, about 93% have employer-provided private or government health coverage. So of that 374,000, over 200,000 are currently eligible for government health coverage, but they don't sign up for it. So over two-thirds of the uninsured are already eligible for a program that exists today, a single-payer type program, and they're not signing up for it for whatever reason. There's another group of people that have enough income but for some reason don't choose to buy insurance. At the bottom line, I guess, with this report is that of all the people, the 374,000 who do not have insurance, of those who do not have insurance and do not have any other way to get it, that number is less than 7,000 people. Now, if that's really the magnitude of the uninsured problem, I would say that that's pretty small. Now, that's not to say, to your point that you've raised before, that some of this coverage may be not affordable or it may not be the kind of coverage that we need to have, and that's a, I think, a different problem. But I look at this and I say the problem isn't with uninsured people, but it may be with the cost of the insurances and the things that are covered. And I think, too, it sort of gets to a question I wanted to ask you about, that you talk about prevention and you talk about needing comprehensive insurance to cover all the things. And that's really not what insurance is designed to do. Insurance as an idea is designed to cover catastrophic risk, catastrophic events that people do not anticipate. And that's how it works, is that most of us don't have catastrophic events that come to us. So we all pay a premium, and only very few of us actually need to have the very large coverage that the catastrophic policy would pay for. And so if you construct a system that is paying for every single cost, that is not insurance, and that cannot be economically sustained without very, very high and increasingly higher taxes out of the public to do that. The preventive aspect of this, to me, I don't understand how this works. As I've talked to doctors and physicians and others, and they say they have a problem with people who just don't like to go to the dentist. Maybe they've got great health insurance, great dental insurance, but they don't like to go, so they don't go. Or they may go to the doctor and get prescribed a medical medicine or a regime of treatment, and they don't follow it. And they have no way to compel people to follow the doctor's orders and to do these things, and yet they later on will suffer consequences from their failure to follow that. I don't know that any program, government paid for or otherwise, that can address that problem unless you want to get into compelling people to behave in a certain way. And I'm sure there are ways that we can get people to do things like exercise more and not eat certain foods or eat more of other foods, and I think there are ways you can compel people to do that. Without that, you're still going to have people who, for whatever reason, decide not to do the things that are good for their health. And this program that you're suggesting can't change that. That's part of the way that some of us are as human beings. We're imperfect. The final point I would like to ask and just raise to you is, and it's been mentioned a number of times, that your program is something that we all pay for. But as I understand it, the costs are largely going to be paid for out of general taxation. And the great majority of the taxes paid, income taxes paid in this state, come from a very small percentage of the people. And so I look at what you're proposing and I say, well, what we're really saying is we're going to shift the cost of a very costly item, which is health care and insurance, to a very, very small number of people who are the wealthiest among us. We're going to make them pay the cost for everybody, and we're going to construct a system that has no inherent design in it that can promote efficiency or innovation or self-directed responsible behavior. And I look at that and I think, how can that possibly be a good thing? So I've thrown a lot of things out here, and maybe you want to respond to some of them, but that's my trouble with your approach.
Senator,
I don't
Marty.
Think it can be done.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, we do disagree. I don't want to debate all of this, but I'm happy to comment on a few things. First of all, I think you're right. What I'm talking about is not insurance. It is health care, and you're right. Insurance tends to cover more catastrophic things. I'm not interested in health insurance. I'm interested in health care, and I think that's what most people want. When we talk about choice, choice is what lots of people who say they oppose this want. But, you know, seniors in Minnesota, I think for Medicare Part D, I think they now have 156 different choices of plans, Medicare Part D plans, for their prescriptions. Most of them don't want to spend weeks looking through these things trying to pick a plan that I believe can change the benefits during the year they're locked into them. They want the prescription drugs. And I think we want them to have the prescription drugs, too. There are some things where preventive care, again, the dental visits. Yeah, there may be some people. Lots of people are afraid of going to the dentist. But most people are a lot more afraid of the pain they get when they have a dental infection run amok. It's very painful. And most people, again, I don't know if I said earlier today, but I think I did tell you about a woman in Wyndham who six of her teeth pulled, 30-year-old woman, saying how wrong she thought it was for a 30-year-old woman to lose six of her teeth because she couldn't afford to go to the dentist. And people really don't like to go to the doctor or the dentist, but they do go when they can. And every one of the witnesses I had here testifying about their personal stories, every one of them had health insurance. They were trying to do everything right. They just couldn't pay the bills. And they couldn't pay the bills because of excluded coverage or deductibles or co-payments. The one witness, I think Ms. Jordan talked about how I think she had like $2,000 deductible, but she was paying at least $8,000 a year for it. And there's some families that can afford that, but others who can't. So, and with the 7,000 people that one report calculated, first of all, the 370-some-thousand was the health department. The Census Department, Census Bureau has higher numbers. I picked 400 is roughly a number that, best guess, is pretty good. But, yes, if they're down to 7,000 who one way or another aren't eligible, first of all, the reason a lot of people don't buy the coverage they're eligible for is because, you know, if I'm forced to buy an insurance policy that I can barely afford or can't afford, I'm struggling to make ends meet, and it doesn't cover my dental care. It doesn't give me access to the dentist, and I got dental problems. It doesn't help. It's just going to take more money out of my pocket, and I'm going to be even less able to afford the dental care that I need. If we have truly comprehensive policies, then you might start getting somewhere, but you do nothing to deal with all the paperwork or the risk. I realize we disagree. I realize you don't support this, and I don't support your proposals, but I did want to make a few responses to that, so thank you.
Thank you. We're going to have to move. We have another bill. Senator Erickson-Robes and Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, thank you for bringing this bill. I just want to make a couple comments because this is really a historic day at the Capitol. I believe it's the first time ever that a single-payer bill has gotten a hearing. Is that correct, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I wasn't on the committee in the past. It may have had a hearing before, but
Thank you.
This is a tremendous day, I think, for us to hear an opportunity wrapped up as a whole package where we have a plan to bring affordable, universal, portable, comprehensive coverage to the people of the state. And some of you know that I just returned last night from Africa. I've been on a medical mission trip there since January 31st, and it's an extremely impoverished nation. And we're working in the second largest city in Tanzania, Mwanza, 2 million people, all crunched together essentially in corrugated tin buildings. There were people on the street who were disabled with their tin cups. Our small group of medical volunteers worked in a clinic that's being started and run by an American group there. And we saw 1,200 people in just about 2 weeks. And most of them brought very, very sick relatives or walked miles themselves to come to the clinic. We saw so many sick babies. And a lot of these people, after they were diagnosed with their problem, walked home because they couldn't afford the medications. They couldn't afford a lab test. And it was pretty striking to me to live through that and realize that our government and the government of Tanzania offer the same kind of assistance to their citizens. And in my opinion, it's a test of a moral government to take care of its citizens and not say to them, health care is a commodity. If you can afford it, if you have dollars in your wallet, you get it. If you don't have the money in your family budget, sorry, you get your teeth get to rot and you have to go home with no medications. So in my opinion, we as legislators are looking at a moral choice here. Do we provide an opportunity for the citizens of this state to get health care that they deserve? Or are we going to say health care is a commodity that you go out and buy, and if you can't afford it, you don't get it? So it's very clear to me that we are all in this together. We all help each other out. I've heard some people say that we shouldn't pay for medical insurance. If I don't need this package, then I don't need to pay for it. In my opinion, that flies in the face of the philosophy that we're all in this together. We all pitch in to help out. I can't afford to hire a private policeman to guard my house. So we all pitch in together and hire a police force to look out for all of us. And I can't afford to blacktop the road in front of my house. So we all pitch in together and get the roads taken care of so we can all drive on the same roads. Healthcare should be the same way. We all pitch in together. Everyone is taken care of, and no one is left behind. Senator Marty, thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Lynch and Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, thank you for your passion in this area and the work that you have done in pulling this bill together. One of the things that I learned first in coming to the Senate and to the health committees is that when we are talking about health care reform, it is imperative that we talk simultaneously about access and cost containment. And I think that this bill before us has a strong emphasis on access. I am less confident and less comfortable in the cost containment aspects of the bill. But I will tell you, and I look at all the people that are here this evening and the people that were here this afternoon and, frankly, the people that we visited with as Senator Marty took the committee out during the interim, and we went to Duluth and we went to Mankato and we went to Rochester and we were in the metropolitan area. And it didn't matter which corner of the state we were in or which district we were in or whether or not it was a Republican district or a Democratic district. We heard the same types of concerns, many that were reiterated here today and this evening. But what I can tell you and what I do believe is that we really need a solution that centers on cost containment. We need a solution that centers on prevention, that centers on quality, that addresses chronic conditions, that engages consumers, that gives people choice, that's centered around best practices. And we need to keep in mind the federal parameters that currently exist and the constraints from which we are forced at this point to work within. I'm encouraged about the work that many people at this in this committee and other committees have done in the past and continue to do, and I'm encouraged by some of the work that I know is coming forward in the Healthcare Access Commission. And Senator Marty, I think that we share many of the same goals. We have different methods of getting there, and I look forward to working with you on those larger goals.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Senator Corrin.
Madam Chair, I would yield to Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Corrin reminded me he's the lead Republican, and I shouldn't speak after him, so I asked to speak before him. We're just having fun here. Sometimes you have to keep it a little bit light. Senator Marty, you and I aren't going to agree on this bill. Obviously, you know that. I do agree with you, though, that some instances, like your witnesses had this afternoon, where someone is losing their home because of a catastrophic health care incident that they could not prevent. There was nothing that they could do. No choice of their own made that caused it. I agree with you that we have things that we need to do. But when I look at this, it's kind of a shift. It's not really, it doesn't fix anything. It's a shift. What it does is make the state the insurance company. And what it does, it still keeps the consumer sort of out in the world of the unknown. The consumer still doesn't know what something is costing. The consumer still thinks that in some ways health care doesn't have to be paid for. Now, I know that sounds really funny because I know that we know health care is expensive, but we don't really know the total cost of it in today's world, and it would be even less so here because we'd have a single insurer. We'd have the state of Minnesota. And what we would have to end up doing, I know people say no, but what we would have to end up doing, you address affordability in here and how things have to be affordable. But in the same bill, you make health care totally unlimited to anyone of any age. So I realize that your intent is not to have totally unlimited care. And yet, in a world where something is free and totally unlimited, affordable doesn't work in the same sentence, because eventually the demand makes it so that what was affordable keeps filtering down further and the taxes to pay for it get higher and higher. So while they might think that the doctor's appointment is affordable, the taxes that are used to pay for it no longer would be. And so we'd go from a system that doesn't work, that's working to a degree, to another system that might work to a degree from a different angle. But we haven't solved the problem. And I didn't get to be at a lot of your committee meetings this summer because I was making use of our wonderful health care system. I didn't have a choice. Well, I did, but I had a wonderful choice. So, but anyway, I would like to see us hear more about the stuff from the Healthcare Transformation Task Force and the Healthcare Access Commissions. We had unbelievable numbers of meetings this summer. Let's hear from them, and let's take some incremental steps that will help, and yes, maybe do something about the catastrophic situations to avoid people losing their homes, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Thank you, Senator Worgen. I want to remind members of the committee we have 9 people who wish to testify about our next bill. Senator Marty, Senator Corrin wanted to speak, and Senator Dahl. Senator
Madam
Marty.
Chair, Senator Worgen, I just wanted to make a couple of comments in response to that. First of all, in terms of your fear of something being free, again, everybody's paying into it. Again, I don't call the police every night because I might feel more secure if they drive in front of my house. Just because it's free. I think people don't overuse things, and the best example I can give is other countries. Germany, it's free health care under that thinking, and they're spending about half what we're spending on health care. And they're covering everyone for all their medical needs. This proposal is not modeled after any other country, and it is, one of the witnesses said how some countries don't cover prescription drugs, and this one does. But the whole concept that more health care is always more expensive. Sometimes we are covering 100% of the people in the emergency room. And when they're hospitalized, we're covering all of them. But we want to present it, deal with it up front. And in terms of the consumer choice and knowing what things cost, I think the whole purpose of those, this is not a bill that we get in the mail, is to tell us how much it costs, how much they would be charged, and how much the health plan allows them to charge, and how much we pay, et cetera. But, you know, consumers can't shop the same way for health care as a vacuum cleaner. I had neck surgery last year. You had complicated surgery for your sister's sake. And, you know, you couldn't have shopped for the doctor and the nurses and the medical supplies in the hospital and the hospital and everything else. For my neck surgery, I think I had one of the best surgeons around. He did a great job. And Regions Hospital was where it was done. And I didn't get to choose which doctors, which nurses, what supplies. It came as a package. It came as a package with my health plan. And if it was a different place, I would take that package. But you can't shop for that, especially when you're in an emergency. So you really can't do the shopping that you'd like to have people do for this, the way a vacuum cleaner can be purchased.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Corian and Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, I promise I'll only take 45 seconds, but I just wanted to just say something, too. I want to also thank Senator Marty because, you know, I'm voting yes. Am I scared of this? Of course I am. This is, and I'm sure you know, that this is like throwing a bomb into the system we have and completely exploding it and having something altogether new. I mean, this is huge. This is huge, and it scares me. But I will say, do I think that our system is broken now? Kinda, you know. I think we got the same problem in education and transportation, with the way we're funding transportation, and so on and so forth. And so, but I'm just in, you know, I'm voting yes because I'm happy that we're talking about things. You know, if you have a couple and they're married and they never communicate, that's not going to be a very good relationship. And so we have to communicate with each other. We have to try to figure out how to fix. We've been sent here with a mandate from people, the people of Minnesota, to try to fix things. And so I'm glad we're doing it. Does this scare me? Very much so. And I'm out of my comfort zone with it. But I'm glad we're talking about it. I'm going to vote yes. The Republicans, we talked about a roll call vote, but that doesn't, I don't think that proves anything and it doesn't solve anything. I think truly, and I know my 45 seconds is up, maybe another 20. But you know what? And I got to tell you that all the other legislators know how I am. I'm not really a Republican, and I'm not really a Democrat. I'm just kind of a realist, trying to get things done. And I believe that all of us, a Democrat, Republican, we all want great health care for our kids and our families. We all want great schools. We all want great roads. And we're all moving in the same direction, kind of. But I think it's good that we're all, you know, talking about this, and I just appreciate what you're doing, and I'll stop there.
Thank you, Senator Corian. Senator Dole.
All right, I'll be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to echo what mostly we've heard here, but I wanted to go back to a couple of things. We talked about cost containment and access and quality and the financing issues, and these are all things that we have to address. Well, one of the things I heard from some of the last testifiers is about competition. And out of the task force, what I've heard is that coordinating care is what we want to move towards, this idea of a medical home. And that if we're going to solve, you know, long-term care issues and bring down those costs, we need to coordinate our care. And that's not achieved by doctors and nurses competing against each other. And that's not the solution to our problem here. We need to be able to work together. And there's story after story that we've heard where that breakdown in that communication has been the problem and why we've then accelerated the costs on a particular issue, which could have been solved earlier on for a minor amount of money, exploded into hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's that waste in our system that we need to address. And it's a big picture, not just about the financing, but about how we're going to change this model, how we think about healthcare, and shift ourselves towards more prevention and to move that model, that thinking. I don't know. We don't have a study yet, do we, Senator Marty, about what this is going to cost? Is that something that you're proposing at all? If not, I'd certainly would myself entertain trying to do a study so we can at least talk about the numbers and how it would play out. I'm just encouraged that we're also talking about this and that it's at the table, because I think it's a viable model, and it's something that has not been given enough consideration in the past. And yet we should probably put a little bit of money towards financing or studying the financing option. But I want to thank you, Senator Marty, for also bringing this forward, and I'm voting for it as well.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. I think we need to take a vote because we need to move with the second bill. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 2324 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Okay, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed by saying no?
No.
No. I think motion carries. Thank you,
Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. We will proceed with the second part of our hearing, which is Senate File 1830. Senator Kubley, is he here? Is Senator Kubley?
He's been here.
Okay, he's coming. And I'm going to start calling Senator Kubley. Good evening. And welcome. We are now ready for you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. I guess, I'd like to present Senate File 1830. We do have a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair, and I guess... in order to get the bill in order,
Mr. Chairman,
be a member of the committee that would move.
Senator Corrin?
Mr. Chairman, I would move. Is there a number on the amendment? Or
A5 amendment.
I would so move the A5 amendment to get the bill in the shape that Senator Kubley would like it to be in.
On that motion, it's an author's amendment, so I'll. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think Senate File 1830, as amended, takes a look at a number of things. I think there were some objections that were raised. I think the people working on the bill have worked with the people that have raised objections to the bill and tried to work with those, and I think they've addressed most of the concerns, if not all of them. Maybe there's somebody that has another opinion on that, but... instead of a new board, they're putting it within the Department of Health so that there won't be, that kind of piece won't be adding to any fiscal note that might be a part of it, Mr. Chair and members. Also, the coalition met with quite a few of the stakeholders to address the concerns that they had, and I think most of those were incorporated into the bill as well. I know they met with some folks from the Mayo Clinic. They met with some groups of pathologists. They met with the Hospital Association and with the Medical Association and with the Department of Health. But there are some folks with me tonight that we could have speak to the bill, and I think maybe we could ask that they go ahead instead of just listening to me for. We'll try and keep it as short as we can, Mr. Chair. I know you've been going a long time today, so thank you for the time.
Thank you, Senator Kubley, Ms. Spanish-Martin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and members of the committee. I am Dr. Donna Spanish-Martin, Associate Professor of Clinical Laboratory Sciences from the University of Minnesota. And I do not represent the University of Minnesota, but the Clinical Laboratory Sciences Program. Since 2000, when the Institute of Medicine published Air is Human, the report that stated each year 44,000 to 98,000 people die in hospitals each year from medical errors, the focus of healthcare has been quality and patient safety. In all healthcare professions, the foundation for quality and patient safety relates to the level and preparedness of the personnel doing the work. This applies to physicians, pathologists, nurses, pharmacists, respiratory technicians, physical therapists, and others. A notable exception is the profession performing the laboratory testing. Over 70% of the objective data used in medical decision-making comes from the clinical laboratory. This includes thousands of different tests that can be performed, ranging from very simple tests like urinalysis to very complex tests like genetic testing or identifying a newly detected antibody to determine which unit of blood can be safely transfused into a patient. The laboratory is not a black box where laboratory results can be obtained through technology. Properly educated professionals are required to determine the accuracy of the results obtained. As both laboratory testing and medical care in general have become more complex, physicians have less time to learn the complexities of laboratory testing, but we need to ensure that the person performing the testing does understand these complexities. First, why do we need licensure? We need to ensure the quality and patient safety by ensuring the qualifications and competency of laboratory professionals. We have provided you with data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which states that licensed personnel performed better than unlicensed personnel on a number of quality indicators. Second, we need to be able to gather data on the laboratory workforce for emergency preparedness and workforce planning. It is difficult to determine a plan for the laboratory workforce needs of Minnesota when, without licensure, we have no good way to determine what those needs are. Third, we need to define the scope of practice for this well-recognized and defined healthcare profession. Currently in Minnesota, laboratory professionals are one of the few healthcare professions that are not licensed in Minnesota. 12 states in the country currently license laboratory professionals. 5 other states have introduced bills, with another bill to be introduced in Texas during this session. About 15 states are currently working on bill language to introduce bills. The impetus for this bill comes from concern among working laboratory professionals about the quality of testing and the inadequacy of the federal CLIA regulations on personnel standards. 10 professional associations, including the Minnesota Society for Pathology, membership organizations representing laboratory professionals, participated in the development of the bill language, and all but one of these organizations currently supports the passage of this bill. The Licensure Coalition has tried very hard to involve other stakeholders, the Minnesota Hospital Association, Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Society for Pathology, and the Minnesota Department of Health, and address the concerns that they have raised. Many of these concerns have been addressed in this bill. You may hear today that licensure will exacerbate the shortage of laboratory professionals. Before I returned to Minnesota, I lived in Tennessee, a state which has licensed laboratory professionals since 1967. Their shortage is not worse than what we are experiencing in Minnesota, and their laboratory education programs were well supported. From my experience as an educator, licensure helps alleviate the shortage because the need for licensed personnel drives the need for recognition and support of clinical laboratory education programs. The lack of licensure is more likely to exacerbate the shortage because laboratory science is more likely to be viewed as work that anyone can do, and clinical laboratory education programs can be closed. A few years ago, the University of Minnesota's Medical Technology Program, the main supplier of baccalaureate laboratory professionals for Minnesota, was almost closed, and legislation was introduced to fund and maintain the program. You can see behind me a number of my students are here that were the result of those efforts that we now have maintained and stabilized that program. Yet other programs are still in danger of closing. As recently as last month, plans were made to suspend the medical laboratory technology program at Minnesota State Community and Technical Colleges due to lack of funding. Currently, there are 3 accredited baccalaureate programs in Minnesota. We are working to expand those to help alleviate the shortage. The University of Minnesota, as you may know, is expanding to the University of Rochester, which will increase by another 30 to 40 additional students. Programs are currently being planned at Winona State, St. Cloud State, Argosy University, and the Mayo Clinic, all of which will help ease the shortage. We have addressed the concerns of other training programs. There are 9 associate degree programs throughout Minnesota and 2-year programs. These programs can produce 100 graduates per year and have nearly full enrollments. These programs need to be supported, and licensure and quality laboratory testing needs to be supported. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
My name is John McClure. I'm a pathologist from Edina, Minnesota. As a pathologist, I am one of the physicians responsible for the quality of the laboratory results in my hospital. Through the course of my career, I have had the good fortune to work with exceptional laboratory professionals at Park Nicollet, through the Allina system, and at the University of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota is very fortunate to have such a wealth of competent staff. The stature and longevity of the program at the University of Minnesota is in large part responsible for this luxury. I'm very fortunate to be able to lecture to the students at the University of Minnesota in their hematology course. They are an energetic, dedicated, and intelligent bunch. Try to look intelligent, guys. The pressures on laboratory medicine in the upcoming years are immense. Our aging population will generate more laboratory testing. Our increased focus on genetic testing will make the complexity of our testing much more intense. Automation in the laboratory reduces the number of individuals needed to run each test, but it makes the process of ensuring quality, recognizing clinical impact, and troubleshooting much more complex. Our modern automated instruments can produce hundreds of results in an hour. The machine will always do it fast. The technologist determines whether it's done well or not. Combined with that increased pressure, there is an increasing gap appearing in our supply of labor. Our laboratory at Methodist Hospital is graying daily. Don't tell them I said that. Our statistics are that 40% of our labor force will retire or will reach retirement age within the next 5 years. We need to do something now. We need to enhance our educational opportunities, and we need to define the floor of our level of quality that we're willing to accept. At present, in the Park Nicollet system, our standards for employment are more rigorous than those required by the licensure bill. That would not increase the standards of training or accreditation for any of our staff. We need to do that now before the pressure hits, before we're short of technologists, so that we can begin to take the steps necessary. Hospitals need to see the deficit in their staff. They need to be motivated to train existing staff and to assist in recruiting very proactively. We need to know how many laboratory professionals are available at the present time, and we need to have, we need to give that information to our administrators so that they can plan accordingly for what quality laboratory testing will cost. We cannot rely on technology and a dumbed-down workforce for the future of our laboratory testing. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Yeah. Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just ask this of yourself, Doctor, and maybe some others can answer it too, but you're the one, you said Park Nicollet mm-hmm. already has a more rigorous standard than mm-hmm. would be accepted here, and I'm sure that must be the case across metropolitan institutions.
In general, that's very true, yes.
But in rural Minnesota, it's probably not the case. They probably have to relax their standard, I'm assuming, because it's a little more difficult to find the type of people that they need.
I think that's one of the needs that was addressed, and I think that Kathy can address that more specifically as to the range of laboratory testing and the range of expertise required for licensure. And I think that there are some provisions in the bill that allow a range of
So our next testifier would be able to address that? Okay, thank you.
Our last testifier.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dahl, I guess, from my perspective, I mean, I live in a rural area. I wouldn't be offering a bill that in any way diminishes their ability to get the personnel that they need. But I also, I worked in a clinical lab myself for a number of years, and I guess I think that a bill like this is needed, and I realize that sometimes, we don't have all the information we need, and sometimes we're afraid to act on something that, we don't know a lot about, but I think that, we don't want to impose a lower standard of health care on a region of the state. Just because they happen to live in a rural area doesn't mean that, our our health care delivery system should have a lower standard, and I don't think that it does. I think, you know, I guess the hospitals that I've talked to and that are in my district are not opposing this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dell.
Senator Kubley, on that point, then I just when I first saw this bill, what I was thinking of is, and you're part of the state, and thinking, well, you know, obviously they must be getting training without this licensure and this educational background. Now they must be getting it on the job training, and I don't know if there's some specific problems. I'd be interested to hear what problems we're really addressing. If there's some things out there that are being created that are big problems, safety issues and the like. And then I wonder if we've got folks that are, you know, want to stay in the area and they can get this job, get the on-the-job training, they're getting paid whatever, maybe, I don't know if it's $10, $12 an hour, whatever it might be, but now they're being required to go and get 2 years of education, spend the money to get that education, to go back to a job that they get paid the same amount on. Where have we gained? I mean, what is this doing for us?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I guess I would hope that they would get more than just the two-year piece myself. I think the technicians, they don't get paid, but the technologists do. But I think there are some safety issues. I realize there's going to be some disagreement on that here, but I guess just from observing the different levels of personnel that work in laboratories, I think there are some issues there that could be corrected by a licensure procedure. So, it's just an observation, but I mean, if we're going to allow people without an educational background to work in this area of healthcare, I mean, why not?
It's an open question.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of high school graduates that are relatively bright that don't go on to advanced levels of education. But if we're going to do it in this area, why don't we do it in nursing? You know, we have a nursing shortage. You know, maybe we could pick up the slack there by sending some folks in. I mean, you know, I think the techniques that are done in healthcare, I think what the good doctor does here could be learned by a high school graduate if he'd be willing to tutor him for a bit. But would you be willing to have a high school graduate determine whether or not the surgeon had gotten all of the tumor that was growing on you if by reading the histopath slides? I mean, you know, I'd rather have somebody who has the technical training and the expertise to know whether one classification of a tumor is missing from an area where they actually, you know, where they think they got it all, but they're not sure. You know, I mean, who's going to make that call? You know, do you want somebody who just graduated from high school, or do you want somebody who has the medical background? I mean, you know, it just seems to me that, you know, it's the same issue right across the line.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. I'm just curious. Senator Kubley, you said you were a lab tech. Did you get this education, or did you get on-the-job training?
My undergraduate degree is in biology.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Wergen and Senator Brettner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kubley, I heard you say, then why don't we let nurses have a high school education and stuff? But I think we have to recognize that there's a pretty significant difference in what each person in each different profession does. Then you could make the comparison, you know, why don't we allow an MD to do neurosurgery? So, I mean, I think there is a difference between what a nurse does and what this profession does, as well as between what a nurse does and what a doctor does and what an MD does and a neurosurgeon does. So there most definitely are differences. And I see your testifier shaking his head. Nobody has no idea how many people in my family are in the medical profession.
excuse me, but I Senator Marty.
Go ahead.
I work with the laboratory professionals every day, and I work with a great many nurses every day, and they all do wonderful work. But I'll tell you, the complexity of laboratory testing is no less, in any way, it is no less than nursing care on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I said different. I said different.
Different. But it is not less complex.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Kubley, or your testifier, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Dr. McClure.
Dr. McClure.
McClure.
Um,
I want to elaborate on this point, because there are nurse aides who are high school graduates, and then there are LPNs, and then there are RNs, and then there are many degrees beyond that, too. Everybody has a different level of expertise and have responsibilities that are commensurate with their level of education and experience. And there are lab technologists that, and you know this better than I do, although I work in the medical profession also, but there are lab technologists that certainly have a higher degree of training and responsibility in the laboratory. Aren't lab technicians primarily phlebotomists?
No. There are very few Senator. There are very few MLTs, medical laboratory technicians, doing phlebotomy anymore. Phlebotomists are typically high school graduates. In some centers, our MLTs and our MTs are doing phlebotomy, but that's very small. It's largely testing personnel for our two-year and four-year degree personnel.
What would distinguish between lab tech with the licensing from a laboratory technologist?
The phlebotomists would not be included within the licensure bill. It would be individuals actually performing laboratory testing and producing results that are entered into the chart.
Would it be, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Dr. McClure, would it be persons who have four-year lab technology degrees that would be licensed?
And two.
Two and four. I don't understand. I honestly don't understand the significance of combining them together that way.
Dr. McCoy, did you want to comment on that? I think there's a lot of confusion about what various levels of things are.
It is very confusing. The CLIA regulations. Boy, if I start on CLIA, we're never going to get out of here. The two and the four-year testing, we are not so concerned about the quality of test results produced by specially trained laboratory personnel. There is a distinction within the laboratory. What we are most concerned about is a loophole in the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act of 1988 that allows for moderately complex testing, which is the bulk of the testing performed in a typical laboratory. But there is a loophole there whereby someone with a high school diploma and on-the-job training can perform that testing without any certifying exam, without any quality standards on what that on-the-job training provided. It is possible for someone to be trained on the job adequately, but there's no way to define that based on CLIA.
Senator Higgins.
Oh, gosh, the deeper we go into this, Mr. Chair, the more confused I get. When Senator Pretner Solon was asking you questions, it seemed to me that she was making a distinction between a lab technician and a lab technologist that I can't see, because I don't know. And then the second question that I have is, you, Doctor, said that somebody only does mostly phlebotomy services these mm-hmm. days. Those people are in the list of exceptions of people who would not have this licensing.
Correct.
Did I catch that piece?
That
right?
is correct.
Okay. So could you explain to me a technician and a technologist, please?
A technician is a two-year degree program. Technologist is a four-year degree program.
Oh, that's why you're... Okay.
Yeah, for the purposes of licensure, they would be viewed the same. Within the hospital, the medical laboratory technologists, the four-year degree individuals, have a greater degree of responsibility than the two-year degree technicians.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, I notice in all of the definitions list at the beginning, it has a subdivision for technicians, but it does not have one for technologists, and you might want to...
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, from my perspective, I guess when I worked in a clinical lab, which has been some years ago now, some labs that you worked in, the technicians did not perform the medical tests that were requested. But, you know, Minnesota...
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, what did they do then?
Well, they...
They drew blood.
Well, the technicians were allowed to perform phlebotomy services. That's true. In some, you know, it depends on where you were. I worked in Washington, D.C. and in Texas and here. But, you know, not every state is the same. But this, you know, Minnesota would allow a technician to actually do the tests. You know, from my perspective, I mean, if I were to have my druthers, I would simply ask that we license the ones that do the tests, which would be the degreed people with the four-year degree. You know, from, and, you know, I guess, you know, I would agree with Senator Wergen that there's a difference of, you know, of a range of services that are supplied. But I mean, what we're doing now, it to me would be equal to certifying a CNA to do a nurse's job. You know, that would be the equivalent in the nursing profession. If, you know, I'm not sure if you would agree with that, doctor, but I guess that's kind of my analysis of it anyway.
Okay.
But, you know, I think we need a standard that allows the people who are actually doing the test to ask themselves some questions. I mean, frankly, you know, if the good doctor here were to supervise the people under him who work under his supervision, I mean, he wouldn't get anything else done. In fact, they'd have to hire another pathologist, and excuse me, doctor, but pathologists that I've known don't come that cheap, and so you probably wouldn't be able to afford one. And so, you know, what do? You run the person you've got into the ground to the point where, you know, they don't want to do the job anymore. You know, and so you lose in that way. But, you know, I just don't think that they can perform the kind of supervision that a lot of folks feel that they do. So, you know, I think it's imperative that we do this, you know, at some point in time. And I think, you know, it may be like other things, we have to build the support for it over time. You know, I guess I hope that we can see the value of doing it now, but, you know, I don't give up very easily, so.
I want to remind committee members that we have seven more witnesses, and some of the questions may be answered with future ones. But Senator Lynch and Senator Prettner-Solon. Right.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Prettner-Solon, I shared, I appreciate your comment because I was kind of confused, too, about who this applies to and who doesn't. But what was helpful for me is on page 5, section 2, line 5.9, there's more than one full page of exceptions. And so I'm sort of struggling with, if this is such a great thing, there's at least a full page of exceptions to it. And maybe we'll learn more about that as we go along. But I am told that there are significant exceptions to this language, and that in fact it really probably represents a relatively small portion of the lab tech. So maybe we'll hear more about the rationale behind that.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McClure or Senator Kubley, is the exam that would be administered to each of these eight categories of ten categories of technicians and technologists, the same test, different tests for each?
And those are established exams by a variety of national organizations that have been in use for many years.
And you're giving until June or January of next year for people to become licensed, and then there's 1 year grace while they take the exam or something like that. How many people do you expect who are currently practicing will pass this exam?
There is a grandfather clause for all individuals currently practicing laboratory testing.
So anybody currently in practice would not have to take the exam.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, I guess, you know, that was, you know, you know, I guess when the coalition was meeting with all the various stakeholders, you know, they tried to respond to nearly everyone's concern. And so, you know, I mean, it looks like it's a down the pike where you're actually going to have a fully licensed profession. You know, I mean, it seems to me that if we're going to grandfather everybody in, that, you know, you kind of lose an entire generation of workers. You know, but, you know, if that's all we can do, I guess, you know, I'm willing to go there.
Senator Prittner, so
Mr. Chair, and Senator Kubley, how many states have licensing?
Ms. Chair and Senator Brentner, so on, I believe there are currently 12. There are two states that also license facilities as opposed to personnel, but it does have some personnel implications. The previous witness before Dr. McClure said there were 5 other states that are pursuing licensing at the moment, and there are 15 other states who are looking at how to put a licensure bill together. So there are 32 states plus the 2 that license the facilities that are in the process or have a licensure bill in place.
Senator Prittner,
Mr. Solon. Chair, Senator Kubley, how many currently license technicians or technologists?
Mr. Chair and Senator Prittner, Solon, there are 12.
You said 12, though, that licensed facilities or technicians?
No.
12?
Ms. Chair and Senator Prittner, Solon, there are 2 that license facilities that have implications for the personnel that work for them. There are 12 that license the personnel.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Prittner,
I'm thinking, I'm from a border state community, mm-hmm. and so I don't know whether Wisconsin has licensing. I don't know. Maybe you can answer that for me. But we get a lot of our medical workers from Wisconsin, and I'm just wondering what impact it will have on them.
Would one of your other witnesses know, perhaps, too? Okay, maybe we'll just wait and move ahead then. Thank you, Dr. McClure, unless there are further questions. Thank you, and
thank
go
you.
Ahead with your witnesses.
Good evening, Chairman Marty. My name is John Thone, and I'm a certified medical technologist, and I'm certified by the American Society of Clinical Pathology. I've been employed in hospital labs, mostly rural, for 30-plus years. Most recently, 16 years, as a laboratory department director at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer, Minnesota. I have a lot of experience and a lot of networking with the colleagues and throughout the state. I just want to, first of all, just talk a little bit about a couple of the acronyms that are thrown out here tonight. The ASCLS is the American Society of Clinical Laboratory Scientists. The ASCP is the American Society of Clinical Pathologists. CAP is the College of American Pathologists. And CLIA is the federal law, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act. I'm going to be using those acronyms throughout my testimony tonight. And I think I can speak to a lot of, being from the rural areas, I can speak to a lot of your questions that you had previously, and I'd be sure willing to answer those questions. The bill defines routes for getting a license and the qualifications for each type of laboratory professional at the associate and the baccalaureate level are included. It states what the degree is required, the clinical experience, and the successful completion of a nationally recognized certification exam. The bill defines 2 types of license at the associate degree level and 7 types of license at the baccalaureate degree level. This reflects the complexity of the work that laboratory professionals do. There are well-recognized national certification exams for each of these categories of laboratory professionals. For most categories of license, more than one examination has been recognized as qualifying the individual for a Minnesota license. Presently, CAP does not certify any laboratorians. ASCP and ASCLS are the major bodies certifying laboratorians, and both bodies are supportive of licensure. And fully, over 60% of the pathologists who are members of the American Society of Clinical Pathology in a survey supported licensure as well. The bill also contains provisions for a temporary license for those coming to the profession with a degree but lacking the clinical experience needed for certification. The temporary license will allow the individual to work under supervision while they gain the experience needed to become certified. Provisions have been included to allow multiple points of entry into the profession. A grandfather provision is included, which grants a license to those currently working, even if they do not meet the above qualifications, based upon the type of work they are doing. The opportunity to apply for a license under the grandfather provision would expire after 18 months. A provision is included to recognize the needs of small laboratories, often rural, and often those in physician offices, which do testing at the waived or moderate complexity level. Individuals that do not meet the qualifications for a license under this Act may perform testing under the supervision of a medical laboratory scientist licensed under this Act or of an individual who qualifies as a laboratory director under CLIA, and this includes most physicians. From a rural perspective, I can tell you that I have already seen and witnessed rural hospitals and clinics hiring medical assistants to do laboratory testing. I do not want to see those facilities hiring a garage mechanic with a high school diploma to do laboratory testing. And yet, this is okay with CLIA, the federal law. Renewal of a license will require documented continuing education, which can be gained on the job and is similar to the recertification requirements of the bodies that provide the certification examinations. It is also consistent with the Joint Commission continuing education requirements. There is no requirement for continuing education by CAP for the laboratorians. It is required by ASCP and ASCLS, and again, they support licensure. My main concern with of why I support licensure is for the quality of laboratory testing for the good of public safety. That is the number one goal, and that's where I stand on this issue.
Thank you, Senator Pittner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief, but I'm still trying to grasp this.
Sure.
What does the certification provide? Does that not attest a certain level of experience?
They're board-certified exams for the medical technologists, the medical laboratory technicians, the histotechnicians, the cytotechnologists. There's board-certifying exams for all of those.
But no, Mr. Chair, I'm talking about the current certification, not the licensing. The current certification, they have those same exams for currently?
Currently, yes.
They don't license the uneducated people.
No, they do not license the uneducated. No, they have educational requirements to be certified. Those bodies do that do the certifying. But what we're concerned about is, like, the medical laboratory technicians have a certifying and a certification process where they can become certified. They have to meet certain educational requirements. Yet, like I say, out in the rural area, we've seen them hiring medical assistants that do not have any certification, and they hire them to do the laboratory testing. And we've seen this because of the shortages of laboratory personnel. And these are not shortages that are exacerbated by licensure. They're shortages because of the baby boomers retiring.
Okay, Mr. Chair, maybe this will clarify. Does this bill then state that only those who are licensed can be employed in hospitals and physicians' offices to do medical tech positions?
Right. Right. And they can be grandfathered into a license, right.
Somebody is saying, no, that's not true.
Yes, it is.
Well, they can be grandfathered in.
Yeah. They can be grandfathered in. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pittner-Solon, I don't think everyone has seen the delete all amendment, and that may be the confusion.
Not everybody has seen. Mr. Chair, I have heard nothing but opposition to this from my district. I've not heard from one person that said that they support this. And so I'm trying to grasp why it is that you're promoting this. And that's the reason for all my questions at this point.
Go ahead.
Chairman Martin. one of the things that happened was after 9/11, the Minnesota Department of Health tried to look and find where laboratories were working. Because we're not licensed, they had no database on laboratories. The thing is, they had a database for nurses. They have a database for respiratory therapists. They have a database for physical therapists. But because we're not licensed, there is no database. Nobody knows where these laboratories are working. That was one of the things that led to this whole situation about licensure. We worked with all of the organizations, all of the respective professional societies, the histotechs, the cytotechs, in gaining their input into the definitions of our bill. We work collaboratively with those organizations. I don't know in your district, I don't know why somebody hasn't come forward to say about supporting licensure, because we do have a vast majority of the laboratory personnel supporting licensure throughout the state.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pretner, so on, I guess, I haven't had anyone contact me from my district telling me of their opposition. I did take the initiative to contact a number of them myself and found universal acceptance. I mean, universal approval of it. So I guess, your experience and mine are quite different, but, clearly someone has contacted your people to tell them to contact you about it, probably giving them information that was in the original bill and not in the delete all amendment. I don't know that. But, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that we run into this kind of thing on a fairly regular basis in the legislature and, contacting people and giving them the information that we're considering tonight. I guess I haven't run into any opposition, so I'm just not clear where all that opposition's coming from, I guess.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was struck by something that you said, Mr. Thone, and you'd help me to understand. You said the hospitals were hiring folks without this degree because there's a lack of workers in the area to do that job, and yet you're saying that licensure is the answer. How would that provide more people to work in that field if right now you currently don't have enough without licensure?
As our previous testifier, Dr. Donna Spanos Martin, alluded to, on educational programs that they've actually shown where there is more people going into the programs within the states where they are licensed. The shortages are coming to all professions. It's just not laboratory personnel. It's everything, dentists, doctors, all health care, anything, teachers, clergy, whatever. We see that happening. We are not immune to that. But the licensure bill would build. You see, what happened was we had the certifying exams, and then CLIA became the law. And actually, when CLIA became law, it more or less took the standards down for who could work in a laboratory because it defined this person with a high school graduate that could work in a lab. What we're trying to do is just strengthen CLIA with this licensure, strengthen it and build on it for the quality of laboratory testing.
And Mr. Chair, then you believe that by doing that, then there will be a large pool to draw from to fill these positions by having this?
I do. I do, because of the programs that are going into place and the working of the programs, all of the things that we're working on to get new educational programs going to train laboratory professionals, as Dr. Spanos Martin talked about.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for this witness? Again, reminding members, we have several more witnesses in favor and opposed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty. My name is Bobby Kachiever, and I have 15 years' experience in laboratory administration. 7 of those years are in the physician office labs and 8 in area metro hospitals. I am also a certified medical technologist. I hope to be licensed someday. I appreciate the opportunity to share how important this licensure bill is, and thank you for your consideration. I come before you today to share my personal views and professional experience. While I currently work at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, my testimony today is as a private citizen and not representative of children's beliefs. I remember as a student being surprised that I didn't have to be licensed. Think about what goes through your mind when you see a professional's license posted on the office wall, or the opposite. Think of how you feel when you hear in the news about someone who's been practicing without a valid license. These stories are about quality, or the lack thereof, and the possible harm they can do to the innocent public who trust these individuals to be who they say they are. Displaying a valid license shows others that you are qualified to do something. It provides peace of mind knowing this individual possesses the necessary credentials and skills to meet the standards. Licensure is extremely important, and that's why this bill is extremely important. I think I have the personal stories that you all have been inquiring about as to what is really going on out there. I'm hearing all of this testimony, but what is truly happening? I represent that face of reality, if you will. A couple stories about what can happen, I believe, due to the direct lack of licensure. As a manager, I am responsible for all of the staffing functions in the laboratory, not necessarily the pathologists. And at one point, to my horror, I did learn that there was an employee working in the laboratory for many years who did not possess the necessary credentials to be performing the clinical laboratory testing. This individual was a borderline performer, and they had been in a performance improvement plan, but it never resulted in termination. Once I learned of the lack of credentials, the whole picture began to make more sense. The organization thoughtfully and expeditiously handled the situation. To my surprise in conversations with my other colleagues, this same scenario has played out in other institutions. Not all facilities require that an individual must be certified, only that they meet the minimal personnel requirements of CLIA. In another story, licensure not only prevents the wrong people from getting in the door, but it can remove people from practice who do not meet performance standards. Although rare, I have had to terminate people. The reality is that some individuals are better suited for smaller facilities or slower-paced institutions. For others, laboratory medicine may not be the correct field for them altogether. As a manager, I have little recourse here because there is no agency responsible for qualifying these workers to whom I can report concerns. So the end result is that we end up transferring these questionably competent people from organization to organization. Once employed, the termination process can take some time. This affords the unqualified individual a fair amount of time where their poor performance could potentially harm someone. I know of one terminated employee who was fired from 3 other places in 1 year. Again, with licensure, the scenario would not be able to play out. As a medical technologist, I worry about who will do my laboratory testing when I get older and whether they will be qualified. And frankly, we should all be concerned about this. I appreciate being able to share these stories with you and to voice my concerns. The state of Minnesota has always enjoyed a higher quality of health care, and we simply cannot afford to let this quality slip. In closing, I want to thank you for your time, and your support of this bill will be a positive step toward preserving quality in laboratory medicine. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kochiever. Senator Hans.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman, and Ms. Kochiever. Appreciate your testimony. Just wondered from your experience, one of the arguments that the proponents of this bill have made is that this is a way to protect the public and to make sure they're safe. And I'm just wondering, in your experience, have you seen people who are licensed or not licensed but qualified as you are causing harm to the public because they do not have a license?
Mr. Chairman, well, currently we're not licensed, but don't confuse that with being certified, because we have certain individuals who are certified. Those are 2 different things. And frankly, there are people, one can argue that even people today who are licensed, there are some people who are questionable even under having that license. However, licensure does give you a governing body that you can take those concerns to. And our borderline performers right now, due to the way HR rules are, if I do terminate somebody because they don't meet the quality of work. I really am not at liberty to discuss that with other people who potentially will hire this individual, and it's why the scenario that played out that I was a part of, it was frustrating for me because I couldn't sound the alarm to let folks know that this was an individual who really potentially could do some harm.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Kochever, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there substance to the argument to say that if a person isn't licensed, they are a potential threat to the public health, which is, as I understand it, the primary rationale to do this? I mean, have there been instances of people in the laboratory situation doing things that have caused harm or injury to the public that would have been prevented had they been licensed? I mean, have you experienced or have any direct exposure to that scenario, or can
Mr. Chairman? Well, currently we are not licensed, so, and I can tell you that errors do occur in the laboratory due to the nature and the criticality of the work that we do, and we are only human. Licensure will not decrease all errors from happening. I don't think that's possible, seeing as we are humans. However, it's another step in the right direction. We can't go for 100% perfection, but we can go for better than we've got right now. And I think it's important to note that we're coming forward, I'm coming forward as a medical technologist. I am asking for that I can be licensed, and I find that the opposition to this is not coming from within the laboratory professional arena. It's coming from others, most often licensed themselves, who are keeping us from realizing that wonderful opportunity as well.
Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Kochever? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Kathy Hansen. You'll be perhaps happy to hear that the witness between Ms. Kochever and myself is not able to be here, so we're one further down the list. I am the Director of Laboratory Operations at University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview. I'm also a past president of the American Society for Clinical Laboratory Science and a past president of the National Certification Agency, which is one of the groups of examinations that would be recognized as qualifying people for licensure should this bill be adopted. I want to go back just for a second, and since there seems to be a lot of confusion, and I know we're a complex field and there are many terms in here that are difficult for people who don't work in the laboratory to understand, but I just want to reiterate the difference between certification. There certainly are lots of associate degree and baccalaureate degree prepared people practicing in laboratories in Minnesota who are certified. But certification is purely voluntary. Hospitals or clinics or laboratories may choose today to employ certified individuals, but they could change their mind tomorrow. And what this licensure bill does is take what good practice is in hiring certified individuals and make sure that it will continue by making it mandatory. I just want to address a couple of concerns that you may have heard from individuals who are opposing the bill. The most recent state to pass licensure, previous to now, is New York State, and that implementation of those regulations has proved to be quite problematic. That bill was developed with very little input from practitioners in the field. You've heard previous testifiers talk about our coalition, which included everybody we could think of who was a stakeholder. For nearly 3 years, we worked on wording, which is not like the New York bill, includes alternate routes to certification, includes provisions for a temporary license for people to become certified, includes the various specialties. That's why there's so many categories. In New York, everybody has to enter through one route, the generalist route. We are including all the ways that people can become competent and certified laboratorians in this bill. And we're also including multiple exams as qualifying people for a license as opposed to New York, which will just have to have one customized exam because of the type of credentials that they're requiring in their bill. The other thing I want to tell you is what this bill does not do. It does not limit the performance of molecular testing techniques to any particular category. All the individuals who are licensed under this bill can practice molecular testing, DNA-based testing, and this has been a misinterpretation of the standards in this bill. It doesn't do anything to change the requirements for laboratory directors, which are well-defined under CLIA. You've heard several testifiers say that CLIA does not have high enough standards for testing personnel. It has excellent standards for laboratory directors, and we are not attempting to change that in any way. It doesn't change the scope of authority or responsibility of the laboratory director. They remain ultimately responsible for the overall performance of the laboratory. Under this bill, they would have better qualified staff working for them, but they're still overall responsible. The bill does not conflict with CLIA, but it builds a layer of higher standards on top of CLIA that matches what most good laboratories in Minnesota are already using as hiring standards on a voluntary basis. So we really are addressing testing personnel only. We do have high-quality healthcare in Minnesota. We have high-quality laboratory practice for the most part. We do know of instances where individuals have done things in the laboratory that have harmed patients. It's very difficult, however, to get permission to come before you and tell you the specifics of those because institutions are not willing to share those except where they're mandated to share them by state law, as in the NEVER events that are reported now in this state. So unfortunately, we don't have lurid stories to tell you. We know that they exist to a certain degree. One of our mantras in the laboratory is CQI, or continuous quality improvement. We know that Minnesota has a high quality of healthcare, but it can be better. And this bill attempts to ensure for the public the quality and competency of those who run your tests. It's all about the patient and the quality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you Ms. Hanson or Dr. Hanson? Or?
Ms.
Okay. You probably can sort out a puzzle for me.
Okay.
In here, there's language talking about waived tests,
mm-hmm.
which the bill says are tests that have such an insignificant risk of erroneous result that they pose no reasonable risk of harm to the patient if they're done incorrectly. And so, okay, these are sort of like minimal tests of some sort in my mind. But then we say that we're going to accept people who do only waived tests. They're in the list of all the exceptions. So then I was looking at all this mound of paper that people were giving us, and there's a statement from the American Society of Clinical Pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And in it they talk about that a CMS study in 2001 found widespread problems with waived tests, including not following instructions for the proper testing, performing poor quality control, bad calibration, inadequately trained or evaluated personnel, didn't follow the manufacturer's storage and handling instructions, and using expired reagents. So I'm trying to figure out how to reconcile these two things.
Yeah.
How a collection of tests that seem to have the possibility for lots of problems are considered so insignificant that we don't really care about them. Can you help me with that?
Well, to a degree.
Okay.
I share some of your frustration about that. Many wave tests are sold in the drugstore for home use. Pregnancy tests, glucose meters, ovulation tests, things like that. The Food and Drug Administration classifies tests as waived and decides which ones are so foolproof that it doesn't take any training to do them. CMS has found that the FDA's classification isn't really always correct, that wave tests are not as foolproof as the FDA would like to have you believe they are. And I don't think anybody believes that if a diabetic tests their glucose at home and gets the wrong answer and does, you know, injects too much or too little insulin, that that's no significant risk of harm. But it's a federal law that we probably can't throw out and change at, you know, in step one of this process in Minnesota. I would like to ultimately be able to include that, but in order to do that, we would raise the ire of the physician office laboratories that do wave testing with uncertified personnel. It becomes, you know, kind of a political reality that we can only go so far, a step at a time.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Hansen, just one more question then. Are there people whose jobs are only to perform the wave test, to perform only the wave tests?
Yes.
And no, really?
Yeah. Not in hospitals, but wave tests may be done at the bedside in a hospital by a nurse or by a respiratory therapist or by somebody who's not a laboratorian. Those are usually under the direction of the laboratory in that institution, however. So that wave testing is probably done pretty well. But there are, in physician office settings, there are medical assistants who do many jobs, some of part of which is to perform wave testing at the point of care in that physician office.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Further questions, Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hansen, does the Fairview organization have a position on this bill?
No. Not well. Actually, Fairview has an HR policy opposing additional licensure, I believe. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've actively taken a stance, however, on this particular bill.
Mr. Chair, I can't help but notice it looks like we're about at the end of the proponent speaking for this bill, and I was did I miss the part where someone was talking to us about the evidence that's suggesting that there's the problem with quality, and is there any evidence to suggest that
Senator Lynch, I think Ms. Kochever did some of that, and Ms. Hansen was telling us why it's hard to, that they can't give stories because of, go ahead, you can speak for yourself.
The witness who was not able to testify tonight is somebody who gets into a lot of laboratories as part of her job, but her employer would not let her come and tell some of the things that she's observed as she travels around the state.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, and anecdotal stories are always great and often interesting. But I guess that I was more asking or more looking for the research and the evidence that suggests that this is a direction that we need to move.
Well, and Senator Marty, you know, we acknowledge that the quality of laboratory testing in Minnesota is generally still good to acceptable. We see the handwriting on the wall in terms of deterioration of that. I think some of the people who testified ahead of me have talked about pressures to dumb down the workforce and hire less qualified, cheaper personnel. We would hope that we wouldn't have to wait until the quality of laboratory testing in this state had sunk to one of the you know, to the lower half before we would make a move to preserve it.
Further questions from Ms. Hansen? Not, thank you very much. Dr. Wheaton. Welcome.
Hi.
To the committee.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Dr. Sue Wheaton, and I have been a pathologist for 11 years. I've also been the director of the blood bank at Mercy and Unity, so I'm very familiar with quality and quality control. I've also been a member of the quality committee at Mercy and Unity, so I'm very aware of quality processes in hospitals. But tonight I'm talking to you as the president of the Minnesota Society of Pathologists. I want to preference my comments first by saying to my colleagues, the laboratory professionals and the physicians who have spoken tonight, that my comments are in all due respect. I'd like to take this opportunity basically to clarify many things you've heard and also to point out why some of the things are not what they seem to be and go from there. The first thing that's really important about laboratory medicine is that the devil is really in the details, and laboratory medicine is absolutely riddled with details. Laboratory medicine is very different from other areas of medicine because it's the only medical field that has an overriding, very thorough, very detailed, all-encompassing federal regulation on how it's run, how it's inspected, what instrumentation is performed there, who can run the instrumentation, what that instrumentation has been deemed to be in a complexity, what educational level fits with that complexity. It's a very detailed scenario. It's not a one-size-fits-all. So I think anyone who's considering licensure really needs to understand the overall federal regulation because that's really a large component of what we're dealing with here. I want to start by just getting back to the bullet points, the real essence of this bill. I should also start by saying that Minnesota Society of Pathology obviously opposes this as I'm speaking for the opposition. So the goal of the bill is to ensure better protection of public health by requiring minimum qualifications of laboratory professionals to ensure that lab tests are performed with the highest degree of competency. I find it a little bit interesting that in the need for evidence in support of regulation, when the question is asked, are there any existing civil or criminal laws or procedures that are inadequate to prevent any remedy or to prevent harm to the public, the proponents answer that question by saying the only current national regulation governing lab environment are those under CLIA, and that they only provide a basement level of regulation below which we would want no laboratory to perform. CLIA is a 240-page document that specifically outlines the inspection, the detail of inspection, how proficient you have to be, the proficiency testing schedule, how the members of your laboratory have to each do the proficiency testing, how they each have to do it well, how those results are reviewed, and how your lab is deemed a quality lab. With that said, there is no Minnesota-specific data to suggest that we have a quality laboratory issue in our state. In fact, Minnesota is in the top tier in the nation in laboratory quality. And people are asking the question, how do you measure laboratory quality? We measure laboratory quality. It's difficult, but we measure it in terms of proficiency testing. You test a specimen, a blind specimen, and you have to get your result, and you check off your result, and you send it in to see if you got it right. Now, that sounds simple, but it's really the only mechanism we have, and it would be basically saying everyone in this room has to take their turn. Here's your blind sample. You have to run it. You need to use your own decision-making, and you have to come up with the result, and you see if you're right. So based on proficiency testing, CMS has shown that Minnesota ranks in the top tier of the country, and in fact, 10 out of the 11 states with licensure
ranked below Minnesota, including North Dakota. We have 3% conditional deficiency laboratories. They have over 10% conditional. So licensure does not equal quality. Interestingly, also, in the 10 or 12 licensed states in the United States, they were all licensed prior to CLIA. So you've got 10 of the licensed states with lower quality by CMS proficiency testing than Minnesota has, and Minnesota is following CLIA, and they were licensed before CLIA. So I think that's just some interesting information. The other thing you're hearing is that I think it's very confusing what's been talked about where is this testing being done and who does the licensure apply to. When you look at laboratory air, none of us want it to be our specimen where the laboratory air happens, right? When you look at the Journal of American Medical Association studies, analyzing where is air the most prevalent in laboratory testing, the two articles that have done the most thorough analysis undoubtedly show that the most lab air testing is in outside of hospitals, outside of clinics associated with hospitals. So non-hospital clinic facilities have the highest risk of air, the highest incidence of air in their laboratory testing. These are physician office laboratories, almost 100%. So when you're looking at physician office laboratories, who works in physician office laboratories and is doing the testing? Physicians, nurses, certified medical assistants. All of those personnel are exempt from this bill. So the highest area you have for rate is not even included in this bill, which I think should be drawn to your attention. The other thing you're hearing is the high school grad. Any high school graduate off the street can come in and test your lab or your sister's lab. And is this true or not true? Yes. High school graduates with on-the-job training that have been shown to be proficient with their testing can run a laboratory test. However, it's under the strict supervision and close supervision of somebody who has more higher qualifications, and they are only allowed to run a certain level of complexity test. Those are moderate complexity tests that are done typically as point-of-care testing or are done in physician office laboratories. Again, that level of testing will not be covered under this bill, and the only level of testing that's really being addressed in this bill is high-complexity testing, which is typically done in a hospital or a hospital clinic. So I think that's really important for you to understand. So what is this bill addressing? It's addressing low quality in Minnesota. Does Minnesota have low quality laboratory testing? Not by the information that we have. We also have wonderful hospital care in our state. Secondly, who does the licensure actually pertain to? And as somebody pointed out earlier, there is an exception page that's quite long, and it is extremely contradictory for what the bill is trying to achieve, and I don't want to blur you over anymore with, except you can certainly ask me, with what the specific contradictions should be. So now we get to the higher level of standards, higher level than CLIA. The licensure claims that it's going to set higher standards than this basement level CLIA. However, if you look at the educational standards of CLIA, which I wouldn't have you do, you'd be extremely bored, and you check them to the bill, they're exactly the same. The educational requirements under CLIA are exactly the same as what's under the bill. The only difference is certification. The bill would require certification, a certification test. Do we have certified licensed or certified laboratorians in our state? Absolutely, we do. Greater than 65% of our currently practicing laboratory technicians are certified. And in fact, our community standard in the metropolitan area and in many other areas of Minnesota are just as this licensure is already recommending. In other words, at Allina Healthcare Systems, Fairview, St. Paul Children's, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Coon Rapids Medical Clinic, Granite Falls, St. Cloud Hospital, all of them have by requirement for their hospital to hire 2 and 4 year degree laboratorians with certification or within certification within 1 year. So the question is, do we need a law to require these standards, or do we expand our current community standards to be across the state? The bill also suggests that firm educational standards are going to translate into increased competency. I think we all know that there's not a direct line between an educational degree and being competent. So I think that's a little bit of a reach. Certainly an educational degree gives us a better opportunity to be competent, but we all know people have the same educational degrees that we have that are not as competent. Licensure will add an unnecessary layer of regulation to an already highly regulated medical field. And I've already covered that with CLIA. In terms of pathologists, licensure, we do believe, interferes with the federal regulatory oversight of the lab. Under CLIA, the highest level of responsibility in the lab rests with the laboratory directors. The majority of laboratory directors in the state are pathologists. We are the ultimate, the buck stops here. Something goes wrong in the laboratory. If you technically track it back to who's supposed to be overseeing that, it ultimately comes to the laboratory director. The Minnesota license bill would interfere with that federal mandate because it puts in there an intermediate layer of regulation, which under the commissioner structure for this advisory board under licensure, gives the commissioner the sole authority to make tweaks in the bill that basically affect the laboratory staff, what they can and can't do potentially, certainly one route is that anytime you make a change to this bill now for laboratory staffing, it's going to need to go through the legislature or it can go through the commissioner. And either way, it circumvents the ability for the pathologist to oversee the lab in terms of our regulations, our federal regulations, which include us to make sure it's adequately staffed, that our staffing is appropriately trained, and that we are running a quality lab. That is really our responsibility. And we do that on a daily basis.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Corrin.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the testimony. It's very, very, very good. But it appears to me like this bill, we need to have some more work done on this, and I think we need to work on it a little longer. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that to lay Senate File 1830 on the table, and maybe a week or so, I'd be always willing to make a motion to pull that off the table, but I would so move that motion.
That is not a debatable motion.
It's not a debatable motion. Senator Coring has moved that we lay Senate File 1830 on the table you said you might pull it off in a week or so, but on that motion, is there there can't be discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hands. All those opposed? Motion does not prevail. Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. While many people in the laboratory personnel do support the bill, not all do. You've heard a lot about the ASCP. The ASCP is a very recognized society that clinical pathologists belong to. And while they do have a very detailed position paper on licensure, they do not actively encourage their members to pursue it. They do support it, but they don't actively pursue it. The Minnesota Society of Cytologists, one of the groups that was included in this coalition, their position statement states that while they participated in the draft of the bill and they're technically neutral, they conclude that their position is this: we are heavily regulated by CLIA, and this would just be another layer of legislation, but that not participating in the drafting of this bill would represent a threat to our profession, limit our current practices, and also our future testing opportunities. While we're in the bill, our official stance is neutral, and we also maintain that the state licensure doesn't necessarily solve the issues of competency or patient safety.
The Minnesota Hospital Association is also concerned that licensure is designed to fence out people and lab positions in a time when we need to increase lab workers. Quality and safety can be assured by relying on CLIA standards. And fundamentally, we do not believe the legislation fixes the real underlying problem, which is shortage. The MMA is not convinced that a separate state body governing lab professionals would have the authority to increase the standards beyond those set of CLIA, and they're unclear whether the bill will solve the problems it aims to address without creating additional unintended challenges. I think we can agree on a few things with the proponents. And those three things are that, yes, absolutely, number one, we do have a workforce shortage. Absolutely. We are looking at it. We're experiencing it. And the question is, what's the best way to address it? Do we address it by having a license in the state, which I think I've outlined really doesn't focus itself on the largest arenas of air? And I guess I'm not clear how licensure is going to help the shortage. I think that it's pretty obvious that we do need to do something about the shortage, and I think we need to spend a lot more energy talking about that. The other thing we do recognize with proponents is that they do need a reliable mechanism to track their workforce and gather workforce data. I think that's very important. I think you should know where your profession is. I think you should know where it's going. And I think it's also important for their emergency preparedness efforts. And I believe, in not knowing the legislative agencies very well, that could possibly be done through a registration component rather than a licensure law. And I do think they bring up a very valid point about needing an avenue to discuss colleagues that they don't feel are competent and to help protect the public in that way. Now, I don't know what other avenue we have for that, but we do see that there are some merits to the issues that they have. But in summary, we would request that the bill not be allowed to progress through legislation, as it does not provide state-specific evidence that lab quality is an issue in Minnesota and that there is a need for licensure to address that. It does not address the very areas of concern it raises regarding quality, and in fact, it contradicts itself on many levels. It does not elevate the current educational standards provided under CLIA. It does not effectively address the real issue of workforce shortage. And it does interfere with the CLIA mandate for lab directors, and it does so without acknowledging any acceptance of the liability associated with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Dr. Wheaton, earlier you talked about how some hospitals have standards that you think would exceed this, and you said you think the solution is to expand community standards, I think was the terminology. How does one expand the community standards? I'm just curious what you mean by that.
How does one expand it? Okay, two things of your question. One was I've mentioned that I didn't mention that hospitals exceed what the bill is recommending. It already meets it. So we already have numerous hospitals in the state, and certainly we don't know how many because we haven't done a study, or there hasn't been a study done, that are already using these standards to hire. How do you roll that out? Every time when I sit on the quality committee, we talk about making a change, or somebody asks about something different, and we start talking about improving quality. One of the first things we do is we look at quality, our community standard. There's no formal licensure. There's no formal law, there's no formal regulation that says you need to be doing it the same way someone else does. But we all try to elevate ourselves to what the best quality practice is in our community and in our state. I think the same could be used here. Now, granted, it's not a legal law that comes down from above, but it's certainly the mechanisms that we already use in many other areas of quality that I've been involved in.
But in other words, it would be hoping that people would, because I was hearing people on the other side saying that they have concerns that as the shortage grows, that people will cut corners rather than tighten the standards.
I think that's a really excellent point, what you're saying. The proponents are saying that as shortage grows,
Hospitals are going to be incentivized to hire and dumb down the workforce. If you go back to CLIA, hospitals will not be able to hire anyone that doesn't meet the qualifications to run that level of complexity instrument that's in their lab. That is the bottom line. You can't dumb down the workforce. CLIA sets the standard. If you have a high complexity testing instrument in your lab, you have to hire a 2 or 4 year grad. End of story. So it's not as if come 5 years from now, the hospitals are just inundated with high school grads running the testing. That would not be allowed under CLIA.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much. Dr. Hansen. You have a handout. We'll pick it up. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Kurt Hansen. I'm a physician and hematopathologist at the Mayo Clinic, where I'm professor of laboratory medicine and pathology and former chair of the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology. I have directed several clinical laboratories at Mayo. I have served in numerous national organizations and committees working on quality and have been involved in implementation of quality systems in clinical laboratories. I have worked in clinical laboratories my entire career. I have hired, trained, and worked with many laboratory employees, and I believe I'm in a position where I can provide some balanced perspective on this issue. As many of you know, Mayo Clinic does not typically take a formal position on licensure issues that arise at the legislative level. However, we do wish to share some concerns that we have with the proposed legislation that would likely affect the provision of medical laboratory services in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to tell you that the licensure bill before you is not needed to address any quality and safety concerns associated with laboratory testing. It has the potential to create major workforce shortages and also has the potential to seriously impede a vital and rapidly growing economic engine in the state of Minnesota. The laboratories at Mayo Clinic are a unique and important resource to the state of Minnesota. Not only do we provide care for tens of thousands of patients who come to Rochester, we also have a national esoteric referral laboratory business called Mayo Medical Laboratories, or MML. The tests we perform are called esoteric because of the level of complexity and are performed in very few laboratories around the country. We are a reference laboratory that performs work on specimens from all 50 states as well as from dozens of international countries. We are continually ranked as a top referral laboratory in regards to quality of laboratory work as well as our commitment to service. Indeed, MML is the referral laboratory for virtually all the top medical health centers in the United States. This should give you an idea what the practice of medicine in this country thinks of the service and quality of laboratory medicine and pathology that we provide. Practically speaking, what does this mean? We employ about 3,500 people in these sophisticated labs. We have had a record of continuous growth in our operations over the last 20 years. We have created between 160 and 360 new jobs each year for laboratory technologists and support staff in our labs since 2004. We hire clinical laboratory scientists, individuals with Bachelor of Science degrees in biology and chemistry, and other laboratory professionals. These newly hired individuals are from Minnesota, Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, and indeed from across the country. At any given time, we will have 30 to 50 openings that we are looking to fill. Matter of fact, about 20 to 60% of the new jobs created at Mayo during this period have actually been from the laboratories. The economic impact of our laboratories has been likened to having a Super Bowl come to Minnesota every year, except without the traffic congestion. The number of CLS training programs in this country, as you heard earlier, has decreased by approximately one-third since 1970. Although there are new educational programs emerging, including a significant education expansion at Mayo, regardless of what you hear, these will still not be sufficient to fully meet the needs across the state and region. In our five-state upper Midwest region, there were 20 CLS programs and approximately 220 graduates in the year 2005. Mayo Clinic's demand alone for laboratory technologists in our growing labs and the economic engine that we have created significantly exceeds the total number of CLS and other laboratory specialist trained in the five-state region annually. Everyone across the state will agree that there is a serious shortage of potential laboratory employees. Question has to be asked, will these added licensure requirements further diminish the supply? which may in turn limit access to laboratory services. For the clients we serve through MML, will we be able to accommodate the growing demands for services? If not, this will have the very real impact of significantly reducing the number of new jobs being created each year in Minnesota. When we talked to Dr. Karen Nichols, who directs laboratory licensure for the state of California, she informed us that California licensed only 61 new CLS individuals last year, and that there are literally hundreds of openings in labs across the state, while others have given up and no longer post position. Licensure, which has been in place for 70 years in California, has not helped California see a growth in the CLS profession. While we are not California, do not think that we can ignore locally or regionally what's going on nationally in regard to the lab workforce shortage issue. This is the basis of our hiring a mixture of new employees, both those with CLS and those with BS degrees in the sciences who would not be licensed in this bill, and then providing appropriate on-the-job training. Indeed, having a mix of these individuals is often beneficial as it brings the breadth of appropriate skill sets together within that laboratory. As you have heard tonight, the laboratory's role in medicine is very complex and hard to understand. Ours is a rapidly changing, evolving field. I'll skip that one. Much has been made tonight about the role of qualified individuals to the quality of work we provide. I have been heavily involved in quality in the laboratories my entire professional career and have served on national committees relative to laboratory quality issues. Quality is a very complex topic, but I am certain that educational qualifications are not a proxy for quality. Education is only one part of the quality process. We and others believe in what's called the quality system essentials within the clinical laboratories that realizes that quality is based on organizational issues, equipment purchasing, document control, information technology, outcome evaluation, proficiency testing, and process improvement in addition to personnel qualifications. If we look at other licensed professions, we all know that serious mistakes occur in fields that have licensed individuals. Licensure by itself will add nothing to our current quality equation unless we look at processes and process improvement goals and systems. From my experience and my national perspective, quality of problems that arise in the laboratory most commonly involve the most simplistic issues, such as making sure that tube of blood acquired from you as a patient actually has your name on the tube with the right test request being transmitted to the right laboratory. It's making sure that the piece of tissue that the surgeon removes gets into the right container that has the right name and the right identifiers. It is these simplistic process issues where we need to be focusing our efforts to improve quality. Serious failures of quality in clinical laboratories have generally been the result of failure in leadership if leadership is not committed to quality. You heard earlier about the Institute of Medicine report called To Err is Human. That report basically said, stop blaming the individuals. Systems achieve exactly what they're designed to do. If the real issue with this legislation is quality in clinical laboratory, then let's approach it directly instead of cloaking it under the guise of licensure. This proposed legislation, as you have heard tonight and raised with lots of question, exempts a significant number of individuals who perform numerous laboratory tests across this state. If this legislation were to pass today, all of you around this table could be hired tomorrow to perform waived and what's been called moderately complex laboratory tests in hospital laboratories and physician office laboratories, as long as they're appropriate training and supervision as defined by CLIA. Indeed, the FDA and CLIA have estimated that approximately 70% of the FDA-approved tests in this country fall into these categories and do not require an individual to have any more than a high school degree as long as they are supervised by an appropriate individual. As Dr. Wheaton stated, this bill does not change this aspect. Indeed, quality data has concluded that the current educational requirements for laboratory testing continue to result in a high quality of care under current CLIA regs. In this regard, the proposed licensure bill creates a double standard for patient care in Minnesota by setting different standards for identical laboratory tests based on employee title and location of practice. This clearly dilutes the argument of linking licensure and quality in the laboratories in the state of Minnesota when almost three-fourths of the FDA-approved tests will not be covered by this law. In conclusion, I do want to restate that Mayo takes no official position on licensure and we truly value the role of our clinical laboratory professionals. However, the specific licensure bill before you does not address the quality and safety concerns associated with laboratory testing, but could instead create major workforce shortages. These shortages would have the most negative effect on Mayo Clinic's ability to grow Minnesota jobs and maintain the high-level medical care for the patients we serve. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share these perspectives.
Thank you. Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Hansen, I couldn't help but smile when you were talking about making sure the right name is on the tube and the right, I can't remember exactly what you said, but let me tell you, in my entire life, I've never been asked my name and how to spell it and what my birthday is as often as I was in a week at Mayo. They don't get the wrong name on a tube of blood.
Again, that comes back to systems, making sure that systems are in place to ensure patient safety.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much. Okay, then Amy Hagen.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Amy Erickson Hagen, and
can you move the microphone a little bit closer? Thank you.
Sure. Hi, my name is Amy Erickson Hagen, and I manage a private lab here in Roseville. And in the interest of time, I just thought that we could look back on Dr. Wheaton and Dr. Hansen's testimonies that they have, and request that if there are any questions, feel free to ask any questions, but I'll just defer back to their testimonies.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson Hagen.
That's a
good job. You and the most Senator Cooper.
Well, Mr.
There
is Chair.
One more. I believe there's one more witness from Fairview. Ms. Gilbert.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert, and I'm here representing HealthEast in Fairview this evening. And I just want to let you know, and very briefly, that we are opposing the licensure and this bill. Not that we don't value our employees, and that it's a difficult position to be in when you are opposing something that many of your employees are supporting. But I think this will be probably the first of dozens of bills that you will be considering before this committee in the context of healthcare reform. And we spent all summer and fall working on healthcare reform. And I think that we had pretty much agreed that we were going to invest healthcare dollars in things that had the best return for improving patient outcomes. And I think that we haven't been able to demonstrate that tonight. And I think that there are many other things that hospitals are going to be asked to do and have been asked to do that we need to invest our dollars in. And all of you who are on finance divisions know that you can only spend each dollar one time. And I just want folks to seriously consider whether this is the area that you want us to invest, because we know based on past experience that when you license a new profession and you add regulation that it does cost us money. And that's why we're opposing this evening. We think that there are other investments that we can make to improve patient outcomes that will have a much better benefit on the return for our patients.
Questions from the committee. Senator Kubli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I look at some of the comments that have been made tonight by the good doctors. If different states have varying levels of competency, it seems to me that we need to know something about what their standard was before their licensure bill took place to know if there was an improvement, I guess, and I don't know as we have that data. But, if CLIA is a high standard, I guess, why isn't there a more uniform level of performance among the various state laboratories that are around the country? It does seem to me that, I think I tried to say earlier that, there are some high school graduates that can be trained to do things. I'm not sure that they can still ask the questions, but, on the other hand, couldn't they also be trained to do, some of the other areas that we have shortages in? Couldn't they do, I realize there are different procedures that are performed, but it seems to me that we could train, high school graduates to do a variety of things. I guess, even though, you know, we don't have any indication because we don't have a standard against which to measure it that that tells us, you know, whether a person with a degree will do better. It would seem to me that a person who has the degree is going to have some technical knowledge that will help them evaluate whether or not the return that they're getting is an accurate one and whether it represents something that the physician needs to pursue on a different level. you know, without a law, I mean, you know, how can you ensure that, you know, not two-thirds of the people meet the competency level, but 70% or 70%, as the Mayo doc indicated, you know, how can we raise that across the board for the field of laboratory science? You know, I'm not sure, you know, that a degree indicates competence in any arena. You know, Dr. Wheaton was talking about that, and, you know, I don't think we're saying that. I think we're just seeking to ensure that the people are equipped with, the people who do the testing are equipped with the kind of knowledge that they need to ask questions that can lead the doc to, you know, maybe order additional tests or to make a diagnosis that happens to be their area of expertise. You know, it seems to me that, you know, I suspect that while we can't answer that at the moment, my own suspicion is that a degree would, in fact, increase areas of competency. I think the Mayo Clinic has, you know, some laboratory testing techniques that are very narrow in scope, and there may not be a test in the bill that would pertain to the folks that they would need for a given area. And, you know, I'm not sure that that education does serve as a proxy for quality, but, you know, on the other hand, you know, I still think that we could do better than we are. So, you know, I would still support the bill. I think there are a lot of compromises that have been made. That's part of the political process. But, you know, once you've made those, I mean, it does lead to inconsistencies, you know, but we've tried to accommodate different groups. The coalition met with quite a variety of groups, including Mayo, in their deliberations over the interim. So, you know, it seems to me that a lot of work has been done, but, you know, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, and I know you already voted on it, but I know that some of the folks who told us that they would support us are not present, and I don't know if it's even correct parliamentary procedure, but I would request that you do lay the bill on the table. I know you voted on that, and maybe you prefer not to, but it would seem to me to be the best move at this point.
Senator Kubley, yes, we will lay the bill on the table. It's 9 o'clock, and I think people are just plain exhausted too, but we will do so, and we'll talk. If you feel you have votes, if you have people who are willing to support you, we can talk about that then. So with that, the Mr. bill is laid on the
Mr.
table.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. Yes. So what, making that, so does it take a majority vote to pull that off the table then, or how are you doing that?
Usually if the chairman lays it on the table.
Right. It's usually,
well, that's
yeah.
What I'm saying. Yeah, I want to know.
I think
you have the discretion to pull it off the table at that point unless we take a vote on it and it goes on the table, then it has to be voted on again to take it off the table. I think that's correct. I think Senator Fischbach is a parliamentarian.
And I'm sorry, I was...
Huh?
I'm sorry
to wake you from your slumber.
I'm Senator Laurie over here. So 9 o'clock at night.
Senator Goring, I will not be bringing the bill back unless there's pretty clear change, because okay. I can sense where the committee is on it. So with that, the bill will be laid on the table, and with that, we are, unless there's other exciting business ahead, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.